and welcome to episode 29 of The Creighton Crowbar. It is the 12th of February, 2014. My name is Chris Thurston, and today I am joined by...
Marsh Davis.
Tom Senior.
And special guest, our first, second, returning special guest person...
Richard Stanton.
Hi, hey. Richard Stanton. Hey! Yeah, Graham is on holiday. Tom is on holiday. Tom, the recently BAFTA-nominated Tom Francis... Yes. Is there anything he can't do? Question. Answers by email. If you know of something he can't do. Tom.
Hello.
What have you been playing?
I'm still playing Dominions, which for anyone who's listened to a previous podcast will know is a very, very strange kind of 4X strategy game, which you play a pretender god in a world full of other pretender gods on the randomly generated world, and you have to kill everyone. By leading your mysterious, weird race to victory. But one aspect of it particularly, like I keep discovering new aspects of it that are just really amazing and aren't done in other games in the same way. And this time it's magic, like the magic system, which I was just getting into their vast magic trees. Magic in games is normally just a replacement for guns. Like it's just a fireball. It's a different way of kind of just a targeted shot. Whereas like magic, it doesn't feel magical. It just feels like a really shitty ability. Whereas in Dominions, the spells are fucking amazing. Like, if you get to the end game, some of the spells are just the apocalypse. They changed the board so drastically that they just completely changed the game for every single player. There's a spell, a high-level death spell called Utter Dark, which just makes everything night. Everything is night forever when you cast that spell across the entire world. And any, non-undead people... They can't see more than like 3 or 4 feet in front of them. They're constantly harassed and attacked by dark spirits who are living in this utter darkness that you've created. And only the undead are really immune to it. And only demons are really immune to it. So, and all economy among like non-undead, non-demon peoples is reduced by 90% because they can't work. They can't make a fucking cup of tea because it's so dark. This horrible eldritch darkness is everywhere. And that you just cast that and it will last until the caster is dead or someone manages to dispel it, which is very difficult. And so in that one simple move, you've just completely changed the rules of the game for absolutely everyone involved in a massively drastic and amazing way. I just wanted to celebrate that. And
Utter Dark sounds a bit like Croydon.
Take that, Croydon.
Yeah. There's another one, which lets you just take control of all the undead across the entire world. So if anyone has any undead, it's like... Dominions models battles, so that it keeps a constant track of the dead on the battlefield once people have moved on. So you know the number of corpses, fresh corpses, old corpses, buried corpses in each province as you go through it. And that's important for necromancers because you go to a place where there's been a massive battle like a few turns ago and you can just raise them right back up. And except for this one spell, it just gives you control of every single undead unit across the entire world. So you just gain armies in every city. And again, it's another fucking apocalypse that you press a button and it happens.
The thing I love about Dominions that I think I want it to be tied in. You know how Amplitude doing like Dungeons and the Endless tying into Endless Legend?
Yes.
Yes, and then into Endless Space. Mm. And having these like little games speak to each other and kind of transfer like little micro scale situations into the macro scale on a strategy game. You kind of want Dominions feels like a simulator for the kind of things people do in the opening cutscenes of RPGs. Like a wizard has cast a spell and the world is in darkness. Kill the wizard to restore light. Yes. Or, you know, an undead army has risen up or whatever. Go and solve it for adventures.
The end game's basically the start of every other game.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of what you want to happen. You want to like be able to take the end state of a Dominions campaign and then import it into like a different RPG and be like, okay, this is, you know, go and kill Tom's obelisk because...
Yeah. A magic obelisk has cast the world into darkness. Go and smash it in order to restore the status quo.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the plot of every fantasy RPG ever.
Or just like the premise for like the most amazing MMO anyone could ever make where some players were playing as, you know, Jim the Baker on the ground or an adventurer or whatever and other players are just like, yeah, I'm a timeless god. I'm a pile of bones and now I control all bones everywhere.
All the bones are mine.
Yeah.
So what do you get to cast if you are the monkey ghost god?
What
kind of spells? Can you cast any spell as any god?
Yes, you can. It depends. When you're creating your god, you assign them points in various forms of magic, but you can spend research time and magic gems to specialise in any form of spell casting that you could choose. There's one called Blood Magic, Which is very difficult because you actually have to hunt the land for virgins and then bleed them in order to gain.
Jesus Christ.
And like, it takes fucking ages.
I love how that's your biggest problem.
Yeah. Well, I thought that earlier.
Not efficient.
I thought that earlier when you said that some things were important to necromancers.
This is how you start thinking about games.
This area, I mean, it's not very close to any schools, and the amenities are all right. It's got an Aldi, but great body count, really important for necromancers.
lots of risings.
Like yeah. Property value and dominions.
You kind of, I think when you play strategy games, you kind of breeze past the morality of what's actually happening and look at the numbers after a while.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you end up saying outrageous sentences like, oh yeah, hunting down virgins and bleeding them, it just takes fucking ages. That's what's really annoying about that.
What is the, how, I don't want to go into this too much, but how is the amount, the number of virgins in a population determined?
I don't really know. Like, I haven't really gone down that magic route because it's inefficient.
Like, could you counter this by having like a really swinging civilization?
Wow, that'd be amazing.
Yeah.
Like we're all really free and liberal. Like,
your magic has no effect.
Yeah.
It's the swinging 60s.
Yeah. You cast dogging. And the blood mages are screwed.
Oh god, this game's getting grimmer by the minute.
Like, this isn't graphic in any way.
Apart from the giant dong.
Yeah, apart from the giant dong. Yeah. You hardly ever see that, though.
Is this the obelisk?
No, there's a god with his knob out. That's just,
oh, wow.
Just, there you go. If you want to be that guy, you can...
God out with your knob out.
Flop around, yeah. Yeah, you set one of your generals to kind of virgin hunting mode, and I'll...
Well, that's like in a drop-down menu or something.
It literally is. Literally is.
Somebody needs to tell the Daily Mail about this game.
Oh yeah, it's fantastic. They wouldn't be able to run it because they wouldn't be able to run the screenshots. It would just be like a joke page. But yeah, you set a general to virgin hunting mode for a turn, and he comes back with some blood gems the next round.
Blood gems?
Or blood? I think it's physical blood in this case that you're kind of storing in vats. I don't know. That has its own spell tree, which is absurd. I've not really investigated it, but that basically opens the Hellmouth at its highest levels. Yeah,
great.
You summon greater demons that you can't control, so they're like the most powerful things in the game. The idea is you just summon them into a province, and fuck knows what they'll do. They could eat you, they could eat the enemy, they could raise them dead, you know, whatever.
Hmm.
Fucking amazing game. Love it. Dominions 4, everyone.
Yeah, it's hard to think of a game with a kind of analogous level of magic outside of strategy games.
Yeah, I guess I'd...
Maybe modding counts as the
magic to itself. It's one thing that just turns the entire rule set of the game upside down. Yeah. And, like, there's a confidence to that it's just so refreshing in Dominions, and I can't think of another game which just fucks with its own mechanics in that way.
Mm.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's that kind of paradigm shift moment, isn't it? When you pick up the gravity gun, that's the kind of thing.
Mm.
Yeah, but... I could talk about faulty paradigm shifts.
What's a faulty paradigm
shift? Well, like when a game fails to... we were just riffing up the phrase Mark... Mark? The phrase Mark used. I live with this guy.
He's a Cylon.
Fuck knows who he is.
It's Marky.
Well, yeah, dear, my cover's fucking blown. But, you know, I had a good run. So, I can talk about this now. I've been playing a load of Elder Scrolls Online. And the first thing that struck me in that game... Well, that's not the first thing that struck me as being a bit off, but the thing that really bothered me, and it links to what Tom was saying about magic systems in general, and this idea that, you know, you're used to a certain level of, you know, power escalation on your character, and then that sense of what you expect the curve to be is what allows games to pull off a paradigm shift and say, like, hey, you're capable of this now. You've just pushed the world into eternal darkness. Now you can pick up Combine Soldiers with the gravity gun, and that changes everything.
Hmm.
And previous Elder Scrolls games, I think, have actually been... especially the older Elder Scrolls games have been a really good example of games that do that. Because there's a point in something like Morrowind where your ability to spellcraft, which was taken out of Skyrim, gets to a point where you can break the game entirely. You know, you can fly, you can...
jump out of skull boxes and things.
Create a lightning bolt that just incinerates any character in the game instantly, and, you know, a magic ring that gives you, you know, 1,000,000% regeneration on everything, and you can, and with mods, obviously, you can break it more and more and more. But there's definitely a point in those games where it's like, you went from being, like, a man in rags fresh off the boat to being Superman. And that was, you know, I think it you know, gave the player the freedom to kind of seriously break the game in an interesting way, and it felt like magic in a way because you've sort of, you know, you've dragged all of these forces to yourself and to do your bidding. And Skyrim dialed that down a bit and took away things like flying so that it could do some better dungeon design, which is a trade-off, which is probably worth it, to be honest, because it allows them to actually build dungeons that are interesting, because they have to put some limitation on what you can do. But the Elder Scrolls Online has one of the weirdest little kind of like attitudes to magic that I can think of in a recent game, in that it treats magic as just stuff your character happens to be able to do pretty much from level one. And as soon as you start earning skill points, because it has sort of open skill point investment system, you can unlock skills that could be, you know, a two-handed sweep with your sword or something terrestrial, or like a new blacksmithing ability, or from one of your starter class kind of abilities, crazy magic shit. And so by level 3 in that game, my character didn't have any shoes yet. I was still the person in rags fresh off the boat, but I could teleport, summon spectral daggers, and turn invisible at will.
You'd think you'd probably just steal some shoes at that point.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not even the narrative dissonance thing, but I think,
man, that happened early.
I just drank as well, damn it.
It's not even that. It's the fact that there's no sense of how the fuck I can do any of these things. Which is actually, I think, quite important when you're building a magic system into a game. Obviously, you can hand-wave it in Dominion, so it's, well, I'm a god. You know, this is why I can do things like this. But in a game that's, you know, like Elder Scrolls Online is, where it's big MMO, it's like, yes, it's an MMO, but it's got a kind of Elder Scrolls attention to detail, and you can play it in proper first person, and, you know, you're grounded in this world in a way that you might not be in another game. You need to feel like your character is at least an extension of you, and you need to sort of understand where their capabilities are coming from. And the moment where you, as a person who's still dressed in rags and using the battered iron sword to kill, you know, wolves, says, okay, level 2, what power am I going to pick? I know, teleportation. A lot of, for me at least, and I know I'm a bit of a nut for this kind of stuff, but a lot of the integrity of the world just kind of crumbles around your character. And
do you think that they did that in order to avert the possibility of their early game being as boring as most other MMOs' early game?
You know, potentially, but
have they traded off like interesting mechanics for their world? Is that what you get?
Well, no, because I don't think it's particularly interesting to have those spells.
Oh, okay.
Like, I would rather have better melee combat, and I don't think that's necessarily an option. The melee combat's super floaty and unsatisfying. Interestingly, like some of the magic is actually the most sort of impactful feeling stuff in the game, because it actually has a real serious problem with combat feedback. Because it's, again, trying to be more grounded than other MMOs, it feels, it forgoes, scrolling numbers or big on-hit effects, and a lot of MMOs mask the fact that there's a dice roll going on under the surface by having a huge particle effect explosion when you hit someone, or whatever. Elder Scrolls Online does away with all of that and tries to be a lot more subtle with it, you know, uses tiny little sprays of blood to indicate that you hit someone, but it ends up being deeply insufficient and feeling like you're not doing anything at all. It feels more like painting a wall from 10 feet away than actually trying to fight someone with a sword. And therefore, the stuff that actually does feel okay is like lightning bolts and fireballs and kind of ranged magic, because it feels like, okay, that's something I don't understand, so I'm not trying to relate to it in the same way. But the game ends up, and I think this is going to be my judgment on the game in general, kind of caught between two kind of masters, where it goes, okay, so the wizard's fine. That guy's just going to throw spells from a distance. His game's okay. We need some way to make the warrior guy and an assassin-y thief person not feel shit. So we'll give that person magic spectral hand blades and teleporting without realizing that what you've just done there is kind of fucked the fantasy of what that person, like the person who picked, I want to play the sword and shield warrior, the armsman, or I want to, you know, pick the, you know, the shadow bladey kind of ninja character. You don't pick those things because you want to secretly be a wizard. You pick that thing because you want maybe a more grounded experience. You're picking an aesthetic as well, and a tone for the game, as well as a character class. Like, it's fine to locate flamboyant kind of magic use in the I'm a fucking wizard category. I tend to pick those characters because I tend to prefer my fantasy games to feel a little bit more like I'm a person in a world. And therefore, to pick that guy, like the heavier tank character in Elder Scrolls Online has like a fiery chain that he can shoot out of his hand, grab an enemy and like reel them towards him, which is kind of cool.
It plays to his strengths as a melee character, right? Because he's
technically from a mechanical point of view, it makes sense. But like when you're a guy who is dressed in rags and using a battered old sword and shield, it feels so out of place with like, I mean, I know I'm maybe being too pedantic about this, but how the hell do I know how to do that? Like, seriously.
I think that stuff matters, though, you know, particularly in an MMO. I mean, one of the games I'm obsessed with and have compared frequently to The Elder Scrolls is Dark Souls. And that goes into unbelievable detail on how its magic is supposed to, where it comes from, like why it works for certain people, why it doesn't work for others. And it's awesome. You know, like, I know I sound like a total nerd here, but like, finding out how Dark Souls magic works and why, like, there's different types of it and how the different types work, why certain people are good at it and not. And all of that stuff is awesome. And the actual, like, this is one of the reasons Dark Souls is so brilliant, is that the mechanical use of the spells often has a lore thing behind it as well. So, like, Ulysil, for example, which is this town that in the original game you couldn't go to, it was the DLC. But this was a destroyed place from ages ago in Dark Souls, and the whole thing was just tricks. Like, all of their magic was, like, stuff that made you invisible, stuff that disguised your weapon. It was just kind of light-bending stuff, you know? Like, that was the only school of sorcery that could produce light, for example. And then, later on, when you go back to Ulysil, horrible shit's happened, and that magic's been warped, but it kind of, like, it was mechanically warped, and it was, like, lore warped as well. And, it was awesome, you know, because you kind of felt that they put so much thought into that system and how it worked that, you know, by looking into it so deep and finding that integrity, you'd kind of, you know, justified the effort they'd put in. And I that's my kind of problem with the Elder Scrolls games in general. I always feel like there's a huge amount of effort put into the surface lore, and, like, what's actually underpinning it, I often feel, isn't quite as strong, you know? Like, certainly in terms of linking it mechanically, I think that series has never been good at it.
That Morrowind is very good at it. One of the RPGs that I completely agree with you for everything from Oblivion onwards. But Morrowind, I think, is one of the most interesting RPGs ever written for that reason. There's a great essay, really long essay, called The Metaphysics of Morrowind by Kate Simpson, I think. We'll put the link in the show notes. That it does a really good job. And the writing of the game is fascinating. As far as I know, one of Bethesda's then developers, I doubt he writes for them anymore, basically just locked himself in a room with a bottle of whiskey for a couple of days and wrote all of the background for it. And it has a cool sort of example. So it's about the sermons of Vivek, who's this sort of like dark elf god, who is the only NPC. Basically, if you read into it and you keep reading all his sermons and everything he said about his existence, he's the only NPC to figure out that he's in a game, which feels like a kind of a cheap kind of fourth wall breaking thing. But the way it's presented is really clever. Like the notion of what the player character is in Morrowind and what those people have been like throughout history and when these people have cropped up. Incorporates and helps to explain things like quick saving and quick loading, but it does it within the case of this sort of like mad kind of Crowleyan ranting about the nature of time and what it is to be a kind of special kind of person as opposed to the rest of us. And that's, it's a neat way of, it engages with the mechanics of the game at such a high level that it does come across as complete madness, but I think it's neat to have that buried away in the game if you choose to go looking for it. Like, a lot of people will completely ignore it, but like, to bring it kind of down a level, the Elder Scrolls did have schools of magic that, you know, and magic behaved according to mechanical systems that allowed you to interact creatively with them. Stuff like mana cost was a sort of fixed thing that scaled with power, and therefore you knew you could do sort of like, you know, constructing spells was a bit like alchemy in a way. It behaved according to rules or chemistry, you know, the rules you understood, and then you could sort of piece bits together, and you'd understood how effects were created from the ingredients you were putting in. Whereas Elder Scrolls Online takes the kinds of things that have been in previous Elder Scrolls games and then just presents, as you say, the surface layer without any of the previous sort of like internal logic that we used to, you know, turn away underneath, which I think is a bit of a shame. And it's a niche complaint against many things I could say about that game. You know, its writing and voice acting are as dreadful as Elder Scrolls has ever been. Its zones are incredibly limited and restrictive, and it's very linear. It's probably the most linear Elder Scrolls game by some distance.
Yeah, see, I don't think that's what most Elder Scrolls fans are probably looking for.
No, I don't think most Elder Scrolls games, most Elder Scrolls fans are going to like it. But the thing that stood out to me the most was it felt like it had gotten the furthest away from what sense of life that game has. And I do think, you know, Skyrim and Oblivion particularly, skimmed the most generic parts of that game's backstory and sort of, you know, like they're in becoming more, becoming less weird, frankly, and becoming a little bit more accessible and trading in you know, trading the kind of the weird sort of avant-garde shit for, you know, big, solid fantasy tropes like, you know, dragons and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They lost a bit of it. The little touches of it that I think are nice in Skyrim, like the dragon language in Skyrim, I think is just a nice story thing. Like the fact that the shouts, the dragon powers you get, are just phrases in the dragon language.
And it is intentionally more rooted in Nordic legend than the kind of, I guess, kind of weird orientalist exoticism that you see.
Yeah, it is. Like, that's why I said Crowleyan earlier, because it does come across as like, you know, a lot of the Sermons of Vivek stuff in Morrowind is like the kind of thing Aleister Crowley would write while losing his mind in Egypt. Like yeah. That's, you know, that's what that game is trying to do, which is cool. It's not an aesthetic of fantasy that you see very often, but it's like Order of the Golden Dawn shit.
Well, I thought D&D was quite good at making magic kind of a coherent thing in its world. So schools of magic are schools, they're academic pursuits. Mechanically, it's represented the fact that you have to learn spells, you have to meditate on them, and once you've actually used them, they're gone. You have to recharge that, and you have to read your books overnight and then get those spells back. But also that even learning them is a difficult process, and you have to actually kind of write them down in the book, and it takes a while to actually get those spells. And it's not like an MMO hotbar ability where it's just like, oh, we need a way to hit that guy at range. Hey, fireball, that'll do it. It's actually, like, you're bending the rules of reality here. It's going to take some time. you're going to have to study a bit. You know, you have to knuckle down, read about it.
Mm.
Just stuff that makes magic and special abilities feel more powerful.
Just returning to one of the points Chris made there when he was talking about how the Elder Scrolls series has changed in general and its arc over time. That's one of the things I'm really, really worried about with Dark Souls 2, which is obviously out in a couple of weeks, and the original is so, its vision of fantasy is so weird, and that's what's amazing about it. And they've obviously had this big success with it, as Bethesda had with Morrowind, and it's like, is Dark Souls 2 gonna, you know, be a little more ye olde dragons and knights rather than the weird world it had the first time around? You know, I'm really, I don't want to say like mainstream, because that's like a hipster's way of saying it. But I do worry about its particular breed of fantasy becoming more bland.
It's funny, when something gets a big audience for standing out, the next instinct always seems to be, how do we avoid losing these people?
Exactly, like Dark Souls and Morrowind to an extent, and I guess you could even say Oblivion, because that still had some weird shit in it. Like, I don't know, these games are successful because they are big and complex and slightly offbeat. Maybe not Oblivion, but yeah,
I think Skyrim is weirder than Oblivion. Oblivion is too much of a step.
The success is like, how do we, you know, repeat this, do it again? It's like, how do we blendify it, you know? How do we kind of make it what it wasn't in the first place?
The thing I was going to compare, the thing that, the Elder Scrolls Online most reminded me of actually in this was Dragon Age 2. Because even though I defended Dragon Age 2 in other ways, its script and it, you know, a lot of its characters and situations and stuff. One thing it did that I thought was a big shame is it completely undid all of the stuff Dragon Age 1 did to ground magic in rules and within a certain context and make it meaningful in some way. And, you know, a lot of those things I was talking about, the teleports, the kind of crazy over-the-top special moves for characters that are allegedly just using a sword, is something that Dragon Age 2 had as well. Dragon Age 1 had sort of quite sort of stolid tactical combat where if you know, fighters just hit people with swords, and they have techniques, but it is just hitting people with a shield, maybe. And also did some cool stuff mechanically where, and I think a good example, actually, of magic actually being used right mechanically and narratively is, you know, the big part of that plot is magic's really, really dangerous, and, you know, people who use it need to be controlled in some way. And if you play that game as I think it's supposed to be played, really, which is with friendly fire on, then magic really is fucking dangerous, and you are really careful about how you know, using an ice spell to, you know, blast away enemies coming through a door, if your, you know, tank gets caught in that, they get frozen as well. And that's, you know, that helps to sell the thing the game is telling you. So the game is, you know, it's a show and tell thing. The game is saying these guys are dangerous, and you've just proven it to yourself by accidentally firestorming two of your rogues.
This reminds me of a story my maths teacher once told me in comprehensive school. Like he just said it. You know, he just said it, like me telling you I went to the baker's to buy a loaf of bread. He was an old guy, Jackie Mitchison was his name, and he used to be a paratrooper, right? And occasionally he'd get bored and he'd tell war stories. And once he just told this story about grenade training, and he said, oh, there was this really thick lad from Harton, Jack his name was, and he was told to pull in the... I'm not going to do my terrible Geordie accent. But basically, his story was that they were trained in how to use grenades, and, you know, they had various bits and bobs just for the throwing action. Then it came time to train with the live grenades, and they were told, pull out the pin, count to five, throw it, and get down. And they all went in, pulled their pin, did it. And this lad went in, and he pulled out the pin, and he just went, one, two. Shit. And they were all just like, shit, and just got down. And then he was like, yeah, we had to clean him off the walls.
I was like, fucking hell.
Yeah. I was like 13 in maths class, just like, what? Anyway, shit is dangerous.
But, grenades are dangerous. And in some fantasy contexts, wizards are also dangerous. Fuck me.
He was a bit like a wizard. Jackie Mitchison.
Okay. What I was going to say was... Shut me. That story has changed my view of wizards.
It's grim.
Yeah, it is grim.
Aside from the fact that it doesn't make sense within the world of Elder Scrolls and so on, does all of that kind of fruity magic stuff that they've inserted into characters actually make for an interesting division of classes and interesting interplay of classes in combat?
I suppose that's what matters, isn't it?
I don't really care about the lore, you know I don't care.
No, it's never a question about lore, it's always a question about whether you feel attached to what's happening.
Right.
Which is a combination of game systems,
yeah, no,
story.
This is one of the reasons I never get into MMOs, is because I don't really find that kind of...
So that's, I would defend this as not necessarily falling into the category of wanky shit I think about narrative in games, and into the category of wanky shit I think about feelings.
Right, okay.
But, like... The yeah, so
feelings
to be honest,
you have about wanky shit, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, what can I say? I don't think it really does. I started a second character actually to make a character I hated less because I loathed my first one so much, and I had a lot more success making a character by picking the wizard class and then deliberately playing him as like a heavily armored warrior wearing using a two-handed sword, because you can use any weapon and armor with any base class. Mm. And that was more satisfying because the magic then sort of complemented the other things I was doing. And there were little combos that I quite liked, like a lightning spell that if someone passed below a certain health threshold after being affected by the spell, they would then explode in a sort of lightning blast that would affect other enemies. And combining that with a two-handed sword felt like it was at least my strategy, very loud strategy, but it was kind of mine. The game still suffers from feeling a bit shit to play, and therefore, you know, it's not... You know, Skyrim has much better combat feedback in terms of, you know, really feeling like you're hitting someone. Mm-hmm. The best comparison I think I could make is those bits in Skyrim when you're fighting a dragon and it's just landed and you've got a little window of time to do as much health damage to it as possible, so you run up and start swiping at its legs. But that's the point where it doesn't really have a hit response to that. It just sort of goes like... Arr! It's a bit like that, but for all enemies ever.
Yeah, I kind of feel that comparing it to Skyrim is like a bit of an indictment in itself. Like, Skyrim's melee combat, I wouldn't say
it's really like
good.
I guess I really like it, but then I modded to shit, so...
On the killing blows, it's great. When you've got I like playing with a Warhammer, and it really feels like you're bludgeoning something into the ground.
To be honest, both Oblivion and Skyrim I played, you know, in terms of combat exactly the same way, which was backstepping with a fire spell coming out of my hand. That is literally combat for me in the Elder Scrolls.
I think the question in, you know, will this game appeal to Skyrim fans is kind of undercut by the fact that Skyrim can be sort of any game to any person.
Yeah, and it's very easy to dig yourself into a hole in those games by exploiting systems which end up reducing your enjoyment, but are actually very effective. Mm. And tend to do that. So I'm weak.
But what I'm saying is, like, you know, if you bounce off the combat in vanilla Skyrim, you have options. You can go on Skyrim Nexus and look up a million mods that have all retuned sword fighting and changed the animations and changed the way it feels, and that you have that is available to you. It's why it's such a hard game to it's why I keep going back to that game, I think, because there's always something new you can do with it.
I think if you'd said all the things you'd said apart from the world is very linear, I think I might still have been tempted by it. But that
I
is
probably
like,
expand on that.
Skyrim is a sightseeing game. Like, yeah. I get quickly bored of doing the quests. Well, I said quickly. After 40 hours, I got bored of doing the quests. And I just wanted to go around and see cool stuff. And that was where the enjoyment lay for me. And the fact you can go anywhere in that world from the off is what is the most appealing thing about it, right? Yeah. And to have places which are locked off to you.
So, yeah, the way Elder Scrolls Online works is... If you've played any MMO recently, you'll be kind of understand the idea of having sort of zones that are gated, so you have to progress a certain point down a quest line before the next zone is available to you. That's how the Elder Scrolls Online works for all of its zones, as far as I know, all the way to the end. So, to the extent that, like, the first time I... So every faction has access to a different part of the world map. And every faction has a little tutorial island, basically. Probably a two-hour quest that just sort of roots you in the beginnings of the game. Which is fine. You know, having something to start players off is not a bad thing. And then you kind of get... After that, you get loosed on the mainland. Except you don't, really. In the case of the Ebonheart Pact faction, which is the one that includes the Nords and therefore Skyrim, you get dumped on, like, the north coast of Morrowind in a particular place. And then you... from there, technically, if you... You know, if you look on the map, you can totally run to anywhere else in Tamriel, technically, though. You're on the mainland at that point. Except you can't, because the passageways between zones are blocked off with these huge gates that you can't bypass at all until you finish the questline for that zone. And that, to the extent that they don't even count as doors, because the game uses phasing, which is where the world state exists in different states for different players.
A powerful magic indeed, making a door and not door.
Yeah, exactly. Someone cast bullshit. but it means that, you know, when one player's in a town, they might be seeing it as a town under attack that they're saving, another player might be in the same town at the same time, seeing the other player, but they see it as a town they just saved. And that's what phasing does, as it was.
Yeah.
Mr. Pandaria was kind of what pioneered it. And I think, and I might be wrong about that.
Guild Wars 2 did that as well, didn't it?
No.
It didn't it?
No, Guild Wars 2 had world states, but they were governed by players. So phasing is when two players can see the same place,
but in different states. Yeah, yeah.
Guild Wars 2 doesn't do that. Guild Wars has, you know, like, areas that go through different states as events occur, and the events might kind of be cyclical.
Right.
But every player will see the same part of the same event. Okay. So if you walk into the, you know, into Orr at the end of Guild Wars 2, you'll know how far along the invasion is at that point. And the invasion kind of goes back and forth always in that particular zone.
Right.
But, you know, you'll at least be still on the same page as everybody else. The only exception to that is Guild Wars uses private instances for certain parts of its kind of like single player story stuff, but those are literally separate parts of the map that you go into, and you're only followed by people that you're, you know, partied with or whatever. But no, it doesn't use phasing.
Guild Wars 2 is a great example of a game with very generous gates. Game where, like, it's got the down leveling system, which means that you could be level 80 and go into any zone, go into level 20 zone.
Great sightseeing game as well. In fact, it had kind of picture postcard moments where you can go up and the camera would pan round. And
just tremendous imagination has gone into all the environments. Like, Orr is this just place of despair, and like this old ruined place that's been warped by old magic. And then you go back to the Asura zone and it's full of this kind of batshit floating cube technology, but in another way it's kind of a green and verdant land. And, you know, every place you go is amazing and different.
Like, and I think so that's why that game is so... I think that game is as important as a comparison to Elder Scrolls Online as Skyrim is. Skyrim's the obvious one because it's like, well, a lot of people are going to come from Skyrim expecting the next game in that series, and that's not what this is. But the other thing is that Guild Wars 2 has a more substantial sense of freedom, and that its world is at least explorable. Like, you know, you can go to a place that you probably shouldn't be, and you probably die pretty quickly because the level scaling works down, not up. It means that, you know, lower level areas stay viable for high level people, but not the other way around, obviously. But at least you can, if you want to, just start running and, you know, go straight away.
You're also totally free if you're, like, just going to anyone else's level 20 area. So there are actually multiple level 30 to 40 areas that you can go to across the map. And if you like the snowy bit and you want to actually go to the 40, 50 area down south, you can just go there and it's fine.
Yeah.
And you're not going to be penalised, you're not going to be tied to a main quest or anything. You're just completely free to go in and level where you want.
And I think it's partly because it's just a much more intelligently constructed game. Like, rather than having to write, like, you know, it's got three... Elder Scrolls Online has three factions, and therefore three roads from level 0 to level 50. And then it has a thing where you can play other factions with that same character, like New Game Plus, after you max out. But that's that aside, they have to kind of create an arc, or, you know, a level curve for those three factions. That have to include voiced quests and loads of phasing and a kind of sense of escalation. Guild Wars 2 just uses the event systems, which kind of create meaning by default, by the fact that they just cycle, and, you know, it trades off the natural drama of, oh, hey, bad guys are attacking good guys, I'm going to go be a hero, which is ultimately what that game is about, right? Like, it's not trying to be anything greater than that in terms of meaning to humanity. It is a I am the hero simulator. And that's fine. And therefore... that allows them to probably create much more content much more quickly, because they just have to create... I remember talking to them about this. I've been to Arena Net multiple times when that game was in preview. That they, rather than having to create an entire quest line, they can just create probabilities. So, you know, probability of big pack of wolves running down this road and attacking some dude. you know, 1 in 20, you know, dice roll is rolled every hour to see if that happens. And then it's done. You know what I mean? You don't have to worry about it clashing with other quests in the area. You don't have to worry about it being too difficult or too easy because it's not the only option. It's just a thing that happens. And from a production point of view, I know it's kind of a boring way of explaining why MMOs are good or bad, but that's really important that, you know, and it's been proven by how fast they've been able to roll out new stuff for that game, that rather than going down the road of we have to basically like create new single player games every time we want to do anything, they can just say, okay, fuck it. If we added a huge fucking bear that shows up every now and then to this zone, players will make that more meaningful than it actually is, right? All we've done is press the periodic bear attack button. And players will go, oh my god, have you fought the hidden bear? I really respect any game development that takes advantage of players' natural ability to big things up for themselves without needing it bigging up for them by a bad script.
Got back into God Wars 2 over the weekend, actually, and did I'm level 80 now, which is top level, so you can go anywhere and do anything. And we did like the Grand World Tour, like on the server, like every Saturday, everyone gets together and does the Grand World Tour of, like, there are these colossal world bosses, like huge dragons that will just land in a zone and everyone will have to fight and kill them for a giant chest. But you just travel the world just fighting them in order. So we all tell you, you know, you go to the Scar and there's a huge dragon called the Shatterer. This is a huge kind of metallic undead thing that lands and you'll pilot that. And then, you know, everyone's like, oh, 10 minutes, the fire elemental's going to go off in this other zone. So we teleport over there and do that and get the chest for that and just kind of go around. It's like 2 hours of amazing, amazing entertainment.
And it's like, okay, it's a bit gamey, but at least it's sort of created a sense of community and event around something. Yeah, it's a very acid thing. But also, I mean, there's that thing as well with Guild Wars 2. When I got to level 80, because the way it works is everyone starts in their little racial kind of homelands and then gravitates towards a sort of central city. And then from there, all the different leveling trees branch out again into a million different directions. I leveled pretty much exclusively in, like, Pacific atolls and, like, desert and, like, tropical rainforests and stuff, got level 1 to 80 that way. And then zooming out and realizing that there were like 5 other ways I could have gone, snowy mountains, deserts, other way, the sort of char, barren bits. Like, that was kind of almost that kind of sense of vertigo, like, oh fuck, there's so much I haven't done in this game. Yeah. And that is the opposite of how I felt with Elder Scrolls Online, which is, oh well, I'm now bored of this zone and I have no other options, so I'm going to quit. A shame.
Bit weird, but like, I felt a bit like that with Tor, but even Tor's planets seem wider and more interesting than...
The Old Republic was not a bad game, I don't think.
I enjoyed it, actually. Good fun.
Yeah. Well, it had way more character than I mean, at least that had decent voice acting.
I'd like to have seen, instead of an MMO, I don't know why they didn't find some way of hacking multiplayer into...
Yeah.
I know that's a big ask with the whole Radiant AI thing, but I'm sure they would have found some kind of contrivance by where you could invite another player into your world and it would be heavily restrictive. Maybe you couldn't pick up quests.
Yeah,
maybe you could only survive with a 100-meter radiant of you.
I'd be much
like
more interested in playing Skyrim with a buddy than playing an Elder Scrolls MMO.
Yeah. I mean, Skyrim would have been an interesting... Or a new Elder Scrolls game, traditional Elder Scrolls game, would have been an interesting... candidate for something like just for ripping off Dark Souls's
summon thing.
Yeah, a summon thing. But
I wish more games would rip that off.
Yeah,
it's so awesome.
Like, that would be an interesting system, or as would like being invaded by the players if you wanted to do PvP or whatever. Like, there's no reason why that couldn't I guess maybe in a game that has this kind of underlying simulation like Skyrim does, an invasion might have to be really heavily moderated, because it would be completely... If someone could teleport into your game, kill a quest NPC and prevent you from ever finishing it.
Oh, they just can't see them in Dark Souls. They see like a ghost of that NPC, but they can't aggro them.
Oh, interesting.
Can't attack.
Yeah, do that then. Basically,
I bet it's a game engine thing where a lot of the world is rendered around the perspective of one player, and if you were to add a second perspective, that would just be completely contrary to coding of the entire thing. So I imagine it's a technical challenge.
Yeah, it's interesting. I fully believe that the limitations of Elder Scrolls Online aren't through a lack of ambition, or even necessarily a design skill. It's through, oh god, we've got to try and translate some of this experience to an MMO, and that's impossible. And the question really should be, if it's impossible, maybe wait until the technology is there. But
controversial.
Talking of invading other players' games.
Nice segue.
What are you in, Bamish?
I've been playing the Castle Doctrine, Jason Rohrer's game, which has been in alpha for quite a long time, I think, although I didn't play it, and finally came out officially a couple of weeks ago on Steam. It's a game about, I guess I should say, first of all, the title of the game comes from a legal precedent, which is the Castle Doctrine, which comes from the Old English phrase, a man's home is his castle. And basically, the Castle Doctrine means that if you come into somebody's house and burgle them, and they kill you, or otherwise injure you, they were within their rights to do so, because you were invading their property. So, you know, if you break into my house and I shoot you, I'm not necessarily going to be charged with manslaughter, you know? So that's what the Castle Doctrine is. And the game is about you having a little house, building your little house, and in that little house will be a wife, two children, and a vault. And all your money's in the vault. If another play... Oh, sorry, I'm explaining this terribly. Basically, you build a death trap to protect these things, and then you go out and you try to rob other players' houses, or you can just wait. And while you're not in your house, other players can invade it and try to either get all your money from your vault, or if they see your wife will take half your money and try and escape. So if they see your wife and they let her go, they can still get to your vault and take half your money, or they can kill your wife and open your vault and get all your money. So obviously what you're trying to do is set up a kind of an amazing death house that kills every motherfucker who would even dare touch your wife and children. And I love it. I've been having an amazing time with it. It's got a bit of a pounding from some people, actually, but I think it's because it's an incredibly unforgiving game. Like, even by the standards of unforgiving games, this is like one false step and you're fucked. It doesn't matter how long you've been playing for. It doesn't matter how awesome your house is. You can kill yourself incredibly easily with your own traps, because every time you've built a death trap, you have to prove that it is completable without any tools. And then you're allowed out, and then that's uploaded for every other player of the game to have a go at. And I've died doing that so many times. Like, you build the perfect death trap, then you go into it and you kind of forget. Like, was it the third door or the fourth door? Ah! And, you know, you end up doing these elaborate tests with, like, you can have pit bulls, but you can replace them with chihuahuas to test. And but anyway, it's an incredibly fun game. It's quite a depressing game, because when you die, that's it, game over. You know, no comeback.
And your house is erased as well, right?
Yeah, your house is erased. When you leave and people try to burgle your house, lots of them will die. Some of them will come in multiple times and check it out, and they're the dangerous ones. You'll see their names, like, cropping up four or five times, and they came into your house. They've, like, checked the outskirts, they've seen where your wife is, but they haven't taken the plunge yet, they haven't gone in. And what you'll find is, the fifth or sixth time, these guys come in with the full works. They come in with, like, saws to get through the walls. They come in with wire cutters. They come in with water, which you can throw on electric floors. And some of them come in with clubs and guns and shoot your wife, or club your wife, which I really don't like. Yeah, so it's like this constant battle against bastards, basically. It really does show that a lot of players are horrible. I don't kill wives. This is just a point of pride with me. I rob other players, and I'm incredibly careful about doing it, but I don't kill their wives. I don't even think about killing their children. Sometimes kill dogs. You know, that's I'm happy with that. You know, on the moral spectrum, I'll take dog killing. But yeah, it's a really great game. And the way it works is really interesting as well, because, once you've set your trap, you've proven it's fair, you go out, it's then uploaded, and there's always a lot. I mean, I can't give you a number, but, like, you see this screen with 10 houses on it, and it'll tell you how much money is in the house, how many people have tried to rob it, and how many people have died. So you scroll down this list, and there'll be hundreds of houses on it, and you're kind of looking for one that's got a bit of money and has had maybe 30 people go in it, but only 2 people have died. So you're like, okay, you know, obviously that's not a total death trap. And, yeah, like, when you get a successful score, all of a sudden you've got more money, which makes you a bigger target. So, like, you're more paranoid, and, you know, you want to replace the wood with steel, you want to get some concrete around your vault, you want your wife and kids to be super protected, because they're, like, If you lose money, you can get money back. If your wife dies, your wife's dead. So, like, the ultimate thing is protecting your wife and children. And you kind of, you get into this awful cycle where you get more and more money and it makes you more and more paranoid and you have a bigger and bigger death trap, which just attracts worse dudes. You know, like, the more money you have, you get the real pros coming in. And you get loads of noobs as well who are like, I'll have a crack at this 36,000 house. And you've just got this film tape of, like, 70 people walking into the same trap one after another. It's, yeah, the best thing about the game, I'll stop talking about it now, but the best thing about the game is that you can watch other people's attempts. So you can watch your security tapes, and it shows you everyone who's tried to rob your house and how they died. And that is, weirdly enough, for a video game, that is the most pleasurable thing in it. Just watching other people play your traps. Like, I can't get enough of it. That's all I can say. I've killed 70 people with my best house. So yeah, fuck you guys.
Or the worst house.
Yeah.
It's been kind of given a kicking because, people find it morally offensive as a game and, they attack it on several fronts, right? They say that the fact that you can't play anybody apart from a white dude,
straight white man,
and the wife is always the subservient and the target, or the victim. What's the defense?
What do I think?
Yeah, yeah. Because it seems to me that it's making a point by that being the case. And it's
Roar. Specific thing, right? I haven't read a gigantic amount about it, but I do know that. I should say, by the way, I'm not necessarily a massive fan of Jason Roar. Although I am quite a fan of this game, I wasn't really a fan of his work before. And but he did talk about the inspiration behind the game was his dad. And Roar was growing up, as I'm sure we all were, in, you know, the kind of late 80s, 90s. And his dad was obsessed with home security. So that's like his starting point for it. I think, you know, if somebody wants to make a game from their experience like that, I don't know. Like, I do get where the arguments are coming from. Like, in terms of, like, representation in games, there are huge numbers of games with, you know, white male leads.
But women being... What's the name of the trend?
Commodities, basically.
Woman in the refrigerator?
Girlfriend in a refrigerator.
Yeah, I mean, certainly in terms of those tropes, they are present in this game. But I think, first of all, people are confusing, like, heroes with avatars. Like, the dude in this game is not good. Like, there's nothing positive about this game. It's not like, it's not saying, like, straight white men who try to protect their house and families are great. We should all be like them. It's saying it's a fucking horrible, grim existence. Second of all, like, it's, I don't know, it just seems to me, like, that he's making that game about that topic, and he should be allowed to. It's not
like there's a specificity there that. That means it's...
Exactly. You know, I
guess that's not really apparent unless you kind of read his reasoning behind it. I mean, is it apparent in the game that that's what he's doing? Or if you come into cold, you're going to have... That's what people get meant.
Surely, maybe not on the specific this is about my father thing, but in terms of the way that it makes you more paranoid and your desire to increase security and protect your family actually makes you a worse person... Mm. I think that is quite neatly explicated by the mechanics, and that's actually the narrative of the game.
I mean, he's definitely... There's a lot of stuff that comes out of the game mechanically that isn't in it kind of explicitly as narrative, and a lot of the criticism it's received is like, Roar does nothing with these characters. And it's like, well, they're not characters. You know, they're archetypes, and, you know, you kind of build the little stories, like, with these great runs you have with the big houses... and, you know, put your own interpretation on that. It's, help me out here. I'm not really sure of the words. But
it's like a symbolic narrative rather than a character-based one.
Well, I think people are kind of looking for the wrong things in it, really. Mm. It's something about a very specific situation that I don't think he intends to be representational of anything. I don't think he's setting up the avatar of the game as... admirable in any way. Like, I think it's hugely negative, if anything. So it just seems... What I do find confusing is I do think the game has questions to answer in terms of, you know, and Roar has done this before, where, like, the woman is, like, the commodity object. Mm. And certainly in this game, like, even though she is, like, the most useful commodity in the game, she's still a commodity. And I do think he kind of has things to think about in that regard. But the virulence with which this game has been criticized, like, I really don't see it. And one of the other things, of course, is the theme, like how grim it is, you know, where you're building this house and your family are getting killed all the time. And I don't know if I'm desensitized or just an awful person, but like, it's so abstract that I never really, like, I do think it's a grim game. I do think it's quite dark and quite depressing in a lot of ways, but you know, it didn't physically distress me. You know, I didn't, when I lost my family, I was gutted, you know, but like, I didn't throw myself out the window.
You did build a memorial to your wife.
I did build a memorial to my wife. This was one of my runs where I had like something like 10 grand in the bank, and I came home and this guy literally just came into my house and he shot my wife, and then he left, didn't even try for the vault, just came in, shot my wife, took half of the money she had. I know. So I built like I had like 5 grand left, and I was thinking, should I just start over? And instead, I built a little cross around her.
Oh,
and but the key thing was, if you went into the area with the cross, you were dead. So, like, if you went in and you saw my mausoleum for my wife, you'd already taken a step too far. There was like a door that had shut behind you, and there were all these electrified floors and cats ready
already
to set
justice,
up.
Already justice, motherfucker.
Cats. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you cats run away when they see a robber. So you can set cats around the house, and as soon as they see the robber, they'll run over a pressure switch. The electricity also works in an incredibly anal way. It's like, it's really correct. So if you have a, like, a wrong switch or a wrong connection anywhere, it just doesn't work. And like, working out how that works is quite hard. If there is one thing this game deserves quite a bit of criticism for, which is it's just terrible at explaining itself. It took me ages to learn how to play it, and I don't see why it doesn't have a description on the items saying, like, this does this, this does that. Instead, you just end up going to the wiki, you know, and, like, I didn't see a good reason why the game didn't teach you better how to play it, because it is brutal. But a lot of fun.
It seems like on the representation front, I haven't played the game, so I can't say sure, but it does seem like it's sort of a missed opportunity that players can't pick how to present themselves. Like, you could almost get a more interesting kind of social reading of the game if players could choose, you know, who they were going
to
be.
But if it's meant to be about a certain kind of white male paranoia protecting the kind of nuclear family, then that is a kind of cultural thing which is worth criticising. And you can only do that by making it specific.
No, I get that. I'm doing a terrible backseat thing, but it's almost like you could swap out that point to maybe something a little bit broader, but actually probably more specific to people who are playing it by allowing people to represent themselves however they saw fit. And because of the mechanic of assessing someone's house and if you're going to invade it, you are then given a tiny bit more information about who they are than you would have otherwise. And it'd be really interesting to see if real prejudices manifest then.
That's certainly never happened in any game
before.
Well, no, exactly. Like, you know, would a sexist player...
Do you really want to invite that kind... I suppose maybe... This is the point, well, it's already kind of a cesspit of morality, so maybe...
Like, if you're going to try and get a reading from people out of the game, then having some way for people to express themselves would make that reading more meaningful, is all.
But it does kind of, like, one of the things about the game is the anonymity of it. Like, everyone in it has... when you spawn, you're given 3 names. So you're always, like, you're not Chris Thurston, you're, like, Chris John Thurston. Or you're, like, Martin Tom Davies. And it's, like... I don't know, I think it's supposed to echo like how they talk about serial killers, you know, where serial killers often have 3 names. And you never know who anyone is. And when your avatar is exactly the same as anyone else's. So it could just be you robbing your house. Everyone has the same... I think the only thing that changes is there's some palette swaps with the clothes, but nothing major like that. I do... kind of agree with what Chris is saying, like, it's not really a big deal to give a player a choice of avatar. I do think in this case, like, it's been a very deliberate thing by Rohrer. You know, this game is about 90s Reagan era white male protecting the nuclear family, and that is what you'll play as. I think the reason he's being called on that is because other games are so shit in representation.
Yeah. Like, other games do that, but like not intentionally.
Yeah, this is one of the few games with a straight white male lead, where the lead kind of has to be a straight white male, but because all the other games just unthinkingly have straight white males, he looks bad, I guess.
I've been playing a game all about player representation and customization. It's called Loadout.
And
you load yourself out, basically. That is the game. It's a multiplayer shooter, team-based shooter, very much in the Team Fortress vein, free to play. And it's kind of unexceptional in a lot of ways. I mean, it's a lot of fun, actually. It's made by Uber Interactive, who made Monday Night
Super
Combat.
Monday Night Combat, yeah.
Which is a good game, good fun game, and this is very similar in the way it looks, kind of big, chunky, cartoony graphics and caricatures. And very splashy combat, chaotic, but its draw is that you can pretty much trick out everything to your particular tastes. So all the weapons, it's basically Team Fortress meets the Borderlands gun customization thing. So every gun has, like, I think 5 different components or elements that you can swap out, and you can kind of add, you can add flame damage to your beam weapon and stuff like that, or you make your mind sticky, or your...
What's your best gun so far?
Well, it's actually your best gun, because I was playing under your account earlier today. I think I called it the Zap Zappity Zap. it was pretty zappy. It was a beam weapon with flame damage, and I liked it. Nice. Pretty tasty. I also had...
Is there a lore reason behind that?
I think Dr. Blam was my sticky-firing pulse weapon.
Very nice.
And I think Daddy Guns was another one.
A lot of these good name sounds weapons. Like beat poets. Or, well, like, you know, someone might scat. You know what I mean? Like, scat in the sense of, you know...
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Be about... Zap, zap, zap,
zap.
Yeah.
Zap,
zap, zap, zap, zap.
Yeah.
Ski, woodly, woo-woo. Yeah, but... having played it for a while, about 4 hours around your house every day, I think I've kind of seen where all the customization goes. Like, I mean, it's interesting. So it's free to play, and there are microtransactions, but the microtransactions are all about the cosmetics. What you wear, basically, rather than what your guns do. And the most expensive item in the game is naked lower half.
Tell me about the flappy dong.
You do have a big, waggly, physics-enabled dong.
Flappity dap dap do up the
flappity dong. Yeah. And it wobbles around all over the place. It's pixelated.
Oh.
But I don't know quite why, because there is another costume you can buy, which is a pair of wife fronts, out of which you can see a swollen bollock hanging. So, and it's not pixelated, so I don't know quite...
Well, quite you don't have to pixelate a bollock. You do have to pixelate a big flappy dog.
Is that the law?
That's the law. There'll be a whole argument about it on our forums. The legality versus illegality of
a big public flappy domain dogs. Scrotum. So I got a Union Jack helmet. I got a tuxedo top.
Sorry, are we still in the law?
No, I was wearing assless chaps for my lower half. Or rather, you were, because this is your character I've ruined. All the weapons, it's got matchmaking, so you never play against anybody who isn't your level, which means the amount of stuff that you can unlock and trick out your weapon is equal among all the players you play with, which is quite a good way of doing it, because it's not pay to win, obviously. And there's a kind of little box out saying, it's not pay to win, it's play to win, because you play to unlock more stuff. But actually, that's not even true in itself, because you're on an equal footing with whoever you play with, because of the leveling system. But the more I unlocked, the less desire I had to unlock more stuff, which is probably not how it should work, because I could just see, like, oh, okay, well, I get to unlock pretty much the same kinds of additions to any of the 4 main weapon types that I have. I can already imagine what a rocket launcher that does fire damage looks like, you know?
Yeah.
And for some reason that didn't feel special to me. It would be much more interesting to me if each of the kind of weapon types had a completely divergent tree, and you couldn't add fire damage to your beam weapon. You could only add it to your machine gun or something like that. But,
Is it not that once you got the premium flappy dong,
I couldn't afford that. That's way expensive.
There's no further paradigm shift. You know, we're talking about paradigm shifts in games, moments of great escalation in your power level, or degree of godhood. In this case, it'll be, well, my pants are off.
Yeah.
There's nowhere else to go from here.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just not seeing it. Maybe they're planning on adding extra stuff. I think there's quite a lot of stuff that's unfinished with the tech tree, because they a lot of the same words are reused on different parts of the tech tree, which clearly aren't applicable. Like, when you have a beam weapon, you can pick three different ammo types. But the one they call slug, which is depicted by a bullet, is just a continuous beam. So, I'm not quite sure. And you can change that for a one that fires semi-automatically, which fires a single shot. But then why would you do that with a beam weapon?
I talked about a lore facetiously earlier, but it does seem that they're kind of just throwing, you know, the properties you might, inverted commas, expect from those weapons out the window in favour of just jamming in the same tree system on each one.
Well, I think it's partly intentional out of a sense of balance. Like, they kind of want to make it systemic how you upgrade these weapons. There's a lot of humour to that game. It looks fantastic, and when you take damage, bits of you kind of fall off in this horrible bloody way. And if you take enough damage on the head, your face is just gone, and you've got this kind of tiny little brain sticking out of this ruptured neck with two little eyeballs in front of it. When you die, it's extremely gory. Like, you end up just, you can survive for several seconds sometimes after you die, but you've just been horribly dismembered and you're kind of just hopping around with blood pouring out of one of your stumps. Which is funny. At the beginning of each match, on the Blitz mode, which is one of the several kind of game types, which is about kind of capturing points, you spawn. Both teams spawn together in what looks like a rugby team huddle, and obviously as soon as the countdown ticks off, everybody just fires and just gets detonated. So it's not a game of really kind of precise balance mechanics, I don't think. But there's a lot of things you can do. You can lay turrets and stuff like that. You get high level. And
where do they come up with wacky ideas like that?
Yeah, well, no, I know it feels This is partly why I'm cool on it, because although I think it's a very solid and interesting game in its own right, I already played it. I've already played tens, maybe more than tens of games.
I was saying to you earlier, like, any class-based shooter these days just has to contend with the fact Team Fortress 2 exists.
Mm.
And like a lot of them, their attitude seems to just be to ignore it and hope things will work out.
I think it's not a bad strategy, maybe, economically. I mean, I assume they did well enough with Monday Night Combat.
Super Monday Night Combat is a very good game.
Yeah, I just feel like, as I was playing it, I was having fun, but I was thinking, does this need to exist? Like, I feel like I've played enough of these games now. I think if this is your first time you played a game of that ilk, you would be more than satisfied by it, but having played many of them, I just feel like the next one really has to do something amazing to me, to satisfy me. And maybe a Waggly Dong should be that, but also...
amazing to me that that wouldn't sell you on this game.
Well, it's free to play, so, you know, it's not too much of an outlay. But I don't know. I don't know that really... I think I'd prefer it if there wasn't any grind to it, and you just had this massive, massive tech tree. And it can create very divergent and horribly unbalanced weapons. That would be more interesting to me than having to grind through these levels in order to unlock different bits of tech and plug them into your gun to get essentially very similar weapons. It's fun. People should check it out. I might, when we get internet in this godforsaken hellhole next week, then... I shall be playing it. I shall hopefully play it with some of the forumites if anybody
wants to play it. Also, if anyone wants to play Strike Vector with me, we should totally do that. Also, I've just realised that we probably shouldn't say Flappy Dong, because it is quite topical by accident.
Flappy Bird.
Flappy Bird's creator, Dong Nguyen.
Oh, God, wow.
I was going to make a joke there, and I'd actually forgotten his name was Dong, so it could have been interpreted quite negatively.
I didn't even know.
Shall we do questions?
From questions.
From questions.
From questions.
You call them questions, not letters. That's
question,
disappointing.
Questions from questions.
It's questions from questions due to a really convoluted series of mistakes.
Alright. I was looking forward to calling myself a Postmaster General. A kind of boyhood dream. Never mind.
You still can.
I'm the postmaster,
Jonathan.
Hey! Okay, our first letter, Dear Baccarat Drowner, it says, with capitalized CCA, and mad props to Chris for spotting that Baccarat Drowner is an anagram of Creating Crowbar. And Thomas from Nova Scotia, you are very clever. Anyway, Thomas from Nova Scotia says that Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup is a roguelike that's been under ongoing duress stroke development for decades. Now that sounds quite interesting. He goes on to talk about a little bit about it and says the hubris is one of the things that gets you every time, even when you have an amazing loadout. The game is brutal, unforgiving, deep, and other buzzwords. Probably his favourite game to play as of right now. Sorry, Tom Francis. Even more than Spelunky. So I hope that reaches across to New York and he feels it in his soul.
Crying into his BAFTA denomination.
Yeah. The graphics may be objectively ugly, though I find them charming, controls clunky, and the gameplay at times unfair, but I just adore plumbing its depths. And he doesn't have a question, he just says in big letters, discuss.
Well, I'm the only person who's played it, because I read the question and then downloaded it. It sounded good.
That's diligence.
And it's definitely not ugly by roguelike standards, by old-fashioned roguelike standards. It's actually quite a nice tile set, but it's very traditional roguelike as far as I can tell. So through the tutorials I started, haven't found any soup. Had a little bit of stone, that was it really. But yeah, I need to delve, plumb its depths a little bit more to actually see what's special about it as
find
a roguelike.
All that soup.
Mm.
All right. On to Dear Crate Smashing Crowbars. I like this guy, he's straight in. I only recently began playing PC games. Welcome. I started with Skyrim in 2011. However, soon, under the supervision of my friend, I was buying, inverted commas, classics, such as Rome, Total War, Half-Life 2 and Civ 4, etc. Which is why I didn't actually buy any new games this year. Thrifty. So what older games should I buy now? Your friend across the Irish Sea... Ronan.
I was going to say, Richard, your habit of saying a single word after a statement that the person has said makes you sound a bit like Jamie Oliver's Twitter account.
I'm really not sure how to take that. Ronan basically wants to know what older games should he buy.
I reckon, presumably he's interested in a kind of spread of PC kind of classics. I'm going to say something that Marsh will disagree with, which is Dragon Age Origins.
Yeah.
That reminds me of Two Worlds, those goblins chase you around going
bleh, bleh, bleh. Yeah, somebody had just been stuck in a recording booth. They also can hire voice actor.
We need a goblin noise.
Bleh, bleh, bleh.
Perfect.
So Dragon Age Origins.
I'd go for Dragon Age. It's a great big large RPG. not only is it big large, but it's a decent encapsulation of I think a lot of things that were good about older classic CRPGs, and therefore saves you going back even further to things like Dragon Age, to Baldur's Gate 2.
I'm going to channel Graham Smith and say SimCity 4. Almost forgot what I was about to say. SimCity 4.
You were about to say the new SimCity. Yeah. Heathen!
I almost exploded. Almost immolated myself in the pockets. I've got a friend who just plays Civilization 2. He doesn't replay games at all.
Oh, Civilization 2 is my favourite.
It's his favourite as well.
Ronan Keating here has Civ 4 on his list, so he may not want another Civ.
Okay.
Fair enough. Civ 2 is great though.
I really liked it when it was 2D, because everything looked all kind of like cartography. Whereas then as soon as they started bringing 3D assets in it, kind of changed the feel of that game. I like looking at maps, nerding over maps, and Civ 2 scratched that itch, and now that we can continue Civ's
hand. Dungeon Keeper's still great, El Centauri's great.
Oh yeah.
Also,
tell you what, why not? StarCraft 2. That's a great game.
Yeah, indeed.
That's great, especially because if the guys don't just come to PC gaming particularly, that's something you definitely wouldn't have encountered.
Mm.
Also, why not Dota 2? Just saying.
Well, I actually know any kind of RTS is the kind of thing you would experience on any other platform, right?
Yeah.
Strategy games, probably, to a large degree, you won't find on other platforms. And a lot of indie games as well. You should kind of trawl through all the kind of indie games that came out.
Yeah, Cave Story.
Gunpoint, perhaps.
Indeed.
BAFTA award winning. Gunpoint.
BAFTA nominated.
BAFTA not yet award.
BAFTA abominated.
Ron and Matey, I would say the first thing you do is go and look up FTL, because that is amazing. And also I would say just sign up to the Humble Bundle mailing list. Not many people seem to know this exists for some reason. They just rely on Twitter, but they have a mailing list as well. And I'm not exactly sure what the timescale is. Is it every month there's a Humble Bundle? It seems to be quite frequent.
There's
anyway.
A weekly bundle, I think, as well, and but it's more specific.
Yeah, if you stick to the main bundles, I think usually you can get a pack of five or six, and they tend to be quite good games as well, relatively cheap. And you're helping charity, which, you know, a man like Ronan, he sounds nice, probably wants to do that, doesn't he?
Sure,
we've invented a lot about this man.
No, well, moving on. Now, we've got a letter from James here who begins, "Dear a drab carton crew," but he then puts in brackets, "It's an anagram," as if we weren't smart enough to work that out on our own. As if Chris wasn't smart enough. I was recently playing The Charming Brothers, a melancholy contemplative adventure game, which induced various nostalgia, etc., etc. And he was talking about how Brothers ties the mechanics into the gameplay very nicely, and then mentions ludonarrative resonance.
Which is the opposite. Hang on, do we now vomit into our cups?
Well, if
let's,
we,
let's bring up some...
If we drink in ludonarrative dissonance, what do we do when they say ludonarrative resonance?
Drink more.
Okay.
I'm on
it. Yeah. Bosh. Drink.
Bosh.
Bosh. He says he went... Anyway,
Christ.
And James basically wants to ask us about occasions when we find this, any cases where we find gameplay and story elements really resonating together rather than acting as strange bedfellows.
Well, certainly in Brothers. Just like I say, Brothers is a great game. I know.
It's top game.
Played it through. And it is like just being kind of relentlessly kicked in the balls.
It kind of tricks you in that way because it's such a kind of traditional fairy tale.
Yeah.
Environment, and then it's fucking horrible. It's fantastic. Well, but yeah, sadly, to explain why it has that ludonarrative resonance would be to spoil it.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, you can explain why initially it has that kind of resonance, which is that you play two different brothers, each with a different analog stick, because you have to play it with a control pad. Mm. And actually, that does. Because you do control them on either stick, there is a kind of division of labour, and there's also a division of character as well. So the different brothers will interact in different ways with the same thing, which is quite interesting.
I was finding it kind of interesting how it kind of, as a right-handed person, I was more inclined to lead with the older brother. And it's kind of interesting to me that like left-handed people, I think, would instinctively lead with the younger.
I haven't played it yet, but I own it, and I will totally test that for you.
Yeah, it would be really interesting to see how...
I found I kept getting mixed up between the brothers, so maybe that doesn't mean anything. I don't know.
I think the game I would pick for this is one of the games that I at first maybe wanted to write about games at all, which was Metro 2033. Because I think that game... I played it on Xbox, full disclosure, but I think that game does an amazing job of tying ideas about its world to the way that you fight and explore. Because it is still a corridor shooter, really, at its core. But the way every single gun in that game operates has a different control scheme, like, which is a small thing. But the way a gun physically works is information you need to acquire at some time when you gain it. So it might be the shotgun that has two triggers, one on each side of the pad for each of the barrels, or the pneumatic gun that you need to pump up to a certain pressure before you can fire it, or like a pistol that comes with a bunch of different attachments and things like that. And in a game where ammo is literally currency, the sort of test shots that you fire to make sure that you're completely au fait with the guns in your hands feel... It's not just like, oh, I've just got a new picked a new gun in card and I'll spray it against the wall because ammo is a generic, you know, consumable that I'll have infinite access to. It felt really powerful to me at the time that I really kind of got something out of feeling like my own experimentation was a legitimate action that was costing me resources and would ultimately bear on my future survival. I really liked that about the game.
I think neither game, neither that or its sequel managed to quite manage its difficulty curve right, but one of the things that could have been good, almost was the way that all combat is about managing panic in a very visual way. So you're wearing a gas mask, or at least some kind of visor for much of the game, and that gets condensation in it, it gets mud and other liquid splattered on it, it can break. If you're fighting a monster, jam gets all over you. There's a lot of, by default, a lot of kind of motion blur on the game, because it's, you know, quite technologically advanced as far as shooters go. And it means that if you get into any kind of dangerous situation, the chances are that you won't be able to see for the ensuing combat. So you're not only kind of... you're not only kind of weighing up the difficulty of killing a beast, you've also got to kind of know where you need to stand and how to kind of escape enough of kind of a fracas that you can you can see for the raining.
It's interesting that I love games where you kind of see a monster and you plan how to take it down rather than just running at it with your shotgun out, you know?
And at any point, like, I mean, certain parts, more so in the first game than the second game, you can be in an environment which is irradiated, which means you need to have your gas mask actually over your face, and you need to be constantly aware of how much oxygen time you have left on your filter, because your filters get clogged. So in the middle of combat, you can have a smashed visor, it can be covered in water, it can be covered in blood, something can be leaping at you, and you'll be running out of oxygen, and you'll need to swap the filter out. And that's I love games that do that. Far Cry 2 as well. I know people really disliked the malaria and the guns breaking. I thought that was great. I thought every combat scenario in that was just about... You basically kind of started it. It was like pressing the chaos button. And nothing would go right. And you would end up kind of like... You'd have this massive, brilliant plan about how you'd take out this entire encampment with a sniper rifle. And you'd end up standing on a single boulder in this kind of burning field while zebras die around you. Thinking, well, I didn't go quite...
I do think Far Cry 2 was brilliant. But I think it was like a couple of parameters being changed from brilliant. Like the guns jamming thing and the malaria, I think, are great. But like, you know, like... half your guns jamming all the time, like getting malaria constantly. Like, if it was, I felt those things needed to be less frequent. Like, the guns jamming in particular drove me up the wall. Like,
it's the thing, like, that game, I think, without things like the respawning checkpoints and that, like, without the artificial layer of difficulty on top of the ostensibly realistic layer of difficulty, I think it would have been fine. Because if, you know, if once you've cleared out a place, it stays cleared out, and, you know, you've just won a battle, then you'll probably cope with the malaria, the jamming guns and everything else.
Did you hear that rumour about the new one being in the Himalayas?
Yeah.
Sexy.
Wow. I'm totally on board for any more Far Cry stuff. Far Cry 3 was great.
As long as it's more towards the, you know, open world side of Far Cry 3 and not the, like, preppy assholes have an adventure.
Not the brohard.
Not the gap year.
No, I think they might have learned their lesson.
Best gap year ever.
I want to know what new wildlife wars will happen in the Himalayas, though, because it was ocelots versus fucking emus in Far Cry 3 with tigers.
I find the wildlife quite disappointing in Far Cry 3.
Really? Like, this is a game where a Komodo dragon can fight a tiger.
Yeah, but, like, they're shit at fighting you. Like, that's the thing, like,
animals! What do you expect them to
do? I expect a shark to kill me. I don't expect a shark to nibble my arm. You know, like, the first thing I did was go out looking for crocodiles and sharks, because I have a fear of getting eaten by a shark. So, like...
You just thought you'd kill all of them.
The first thing I do in any game with sharks in is get eaten by sharks, because it gives me a kind of weird frisson.
Like Hemingway, machine-gunning
sharks. Yeah, exactly. Almost sexual. But I was incredibly disappointed by the sharks in Far Cry 3. They didn't even give me a semi. Sorry, returning to... good question, James.
Did we answer that? Oh, fuck
yeah, no. Yeah. All I'd say is Dark Souls.
The only thing being gripped was your arm by a shark.
Oh, my God. I'm glad we didn't come up with a podcast title out of that.
Kind of sharks there.
Anyway, moving swiftly on. We're on to Mr. Higgins here. I'm not going to read his letter because it's really, really long. But it began, Hey, guys. Look, there's not...
Are you really giving up on
that? Yeah, I mean, well, he thinks he's the Fonz. You know, it's like, give us a joke, mate. You're lucky you're getting read out at all. So Mr. Higgins is talking about how he's reached the stage, all of us have, where he's got a bit less time than he used to. He can only play 1 to 2 hours a day on average, and he gets confused at the great epic 30-hour story arcs we get in FPSs. And I'm just going to read a short bit here. I've yet to play an episodic game, and maybe that's how they do it. Oh no, sorry, I need a line earlier. Episodic games are even worse because of the gap between the releases, even though they are more easily played in one sitting. It makes me think of television shows where there is an arcing story throughout the season, but each episode has a shorter story wrapped up in the length of that episode, i.e. a murder is solved. I have yet to play an episodic game, and maybe that's how they do it. I would like your guys' thoughts on this matter.
That is how they do it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, they're all kind of procedurals, which is why it's kind of...
But basically he's saying he only has a couple of hours a week to play games, and he's getting very confused with these arcing stories. And I have quite a lot of sympathy with that. I went back into Bioshock Infinite. I had no idea what was going on. You know, I remembered Elizabeth was my mate, but that was about it.
Yeah.
Episodic gaming?
Well, I don't know about that, but I mean, like, certainly... a lot of shooters could do with being trimmed down. Like Bioshock Infinite felt like a slog for me for the last third, probably. Maybe even longer than that. I think I feel that way about a lot of shooters, because essentially you're exploring the same mechanics, and the rate of escalation isn't necessarily always there.
Mm. I'm going to say the same thing I always say. Games should be cheaper. And this is important in this case, because the reason that you can't say, just shorten the games, make them snappier, build them around their, you know, strengths and don't pad them out, is that, you know, games are expensive. And they represent an investment by the people who choose to play them, especially in their launch, where they expect to get a certain amount of entertainment. And you have guys in this guy's situation where he's got a couple of hours a week to play and kind of wants to get through it quickly. But you've also got person for whom that's their one game for however long, you know, that's their... You know, they've chosen to buy Bioshock Infinite release, and they expect to get a substantial amount of entertainment out of their £40 or whatever. And both positions are valid. And the answer, I think, to please both people is to make games less of a strenuous investment for people, so that someone who can only play a few hours a week, maybe doesn't solve the problem with the narrative being overstretched or whatever, can at least feel less shortchanged if they don't get everything out of that game in the time they have to play it. But likewise, the person who will consume it quickly nonetheless doesn't have to then sort of sit on their, you know, hands waiting for the next game to come out, because they haven't spent all of their money.
I talked a bit previously about Wolf Among Us Episode 2, which is a bit of a down curve from the first one. But I think there's, like in episodic gaming, people lean back on television episodic structure too much. Like a cliffhanger on a TV show that you're going to see next week is a tease and it's not painful. But a cliffhanger at the end of episode 2, when you know it's going to be 6 months until the next thing, is fucking painful. Is it a thing that is kind of an interesting taunt, becomes just a cruel taunt? Like, that's what happens when you just unthinkingly just repeat what television does, you know?
Sure. But also, you kind of just, you can't capture the same level of momentum that you had going from an episode to another episode of a TV show than you can doing what happened last time on The Wolf Among Us, because that was 6 months ago, and no matter how well they synopsize it, you're going to lose some kind of part of that
atmosphere. You know, not even playing Devil's Advocate. Is it New Eden that made Test Drive Unlimited? Eden Games. They made Alone in the Dark about 4 or 5 years ago. And I don't know if any of you guys have played Alone in the Dark, but that, I think, is the best worst game ever. And it did so much wrong. Like, it really is not a great game, but so many of the ideas in it are great, and it's episodic. So the whole game would probably take you 20 or 30 hours, but every time you start up, it is out on PC now, but I played it on the Xbox. Every time you start it up and you play, it does what a TV show would go. It goes previously on Alone in the Dark, and it shows...
It's designed to be played in chunks, right?
Yeah, it shows like little scenes from what you've done previously, and it kind of... Yeah, obviously it's not quite as slick as...
Alan Wake did this as well,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Alan Wake did it as well. But actually, I think in Alone in the Dark, they did a better job of segmenting their plot. It really was, like, lots of mini cliffhangers and then an overall arc. And if the game itself didn't suck, like, it was a brilliant structure.
Yeah,
like, but
really
they showed a way that you could do a 20-hour game and make it make sense to somebody who could only play it for an hour at a time infrequently.
Man, that'd be an amazing feature to have in, like, the next Mass Effect or whatever. Like,
yeah, they're the kind of games that really
like,
need it.
Because I remember, this is a bit of an anecdote, but I pitched this to the lead designer of Dragon Age, like, before I was a games designer, while I was kind of, like, freelancing about and aspiring, I met Mike Laidlaw, not Mark Laidlaw. One of the M Laidlaws is Valve, the other one is Bauer. And I was in a discussion about how they have to do these trailers where they have to present a kind of idealized version of the main character, a main character who will ultimately, whose gender, etc., will ultimately be determined by the player. So you have these trailers. This at the time was for Dragon Age 2, where Hawk was a guy with a beard, but could easily have been a woman, you know, and therefore that was kind of a weird situation for them to find themselves in, where they're making promotional material for the game that is generated out of an imagined version of the main character, which is kind of strange. And I was like, well, wouldn't it be interesting from a game promotion point of view, not even from a game design point of view, if when you finished the game just generated a trailer for the game based on your character and the decisions you made, and then that was the thing you shared. So that after launch, at least, the promotional material for the game wasn't, you know, fake vanilla Shepard or fake vanilla Hawk at all.
It was yours.
But the diverse Hawks and Shepherds of every player.
That's actually what happens with the Wolf Among Us, isn't it? At the end of each episode, it says next time, and then it shows you clips of what will happen based on your decisions.
Yeah, and that's I think that's really involving fun. Players in that is interesting. And like, if the next Dragon Age or Mass Effect game had just a really simple cutscene system where it would. Like, we ended up so deep in this discussion that it ended up being about how to manage the memory required to load different levels from the game to show different choices alongside each other. But, like, if it just went, like, previously, last time you played Mass Effect, and then just, like, did, like, three different choice moments where you go, like, no, I hate orphans, and then, like, flash cut to, yes, I will take the enormous gun. Like, that'd be awesome.
So, moving swiftly on, we've got a letter here, very good letter actually, from Davey G. He says, "Dear Bitcrate and Coinbar, in episode 27..."
Oh no, we're deprecating!
"In episode 27, you were very critical, or at least guessed Rich was, of COD having toys for sale to kids when the games are violent, adult, and generally age-rated. While it may not be pleasant, it is not without precedent." And Davey G talks about how when he was a kid, he had Terminator and Robocop toys, as I'm sure we all did. And this is not a new thing. So to my question, do you think the industry is doing enough to protect kids? Are the parents to blame for not paying enough attention? Or are kids just doing what we used to do when we used to steal the video of A Nightmare on Elm Street?
No, yes, I believe. No, the games industry isn't doing enough. Yes, parents are also to blame, and yes, children will go and watch things that are too old for them anyway.
I kind of agree with Martin, but there's also a degree to this, which is it's kind of a generational thing. Like, you know, Rich, you're a father.
I am.
Your children will necessarily grow up with a parent who knows more about this new medium than yours did.
I think so, but I also think the parental role in this is slightly overstated. Like, it does kind of bug me when the OFT, the Office of Fair Trading, did a report on children's games a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things it said was that all these bad practices in children's games are bad, but parents should be playing the games with their children. And I just think, bollocks to that. Like, I don't have time to play a game before my child plays it. Like, if you're making a game for children that needs to be played with adult supervision... The problem is with the game, you know. It's not with like adults being able to supervise or even adults turning off their settings. I don't have a lot of sympathy for the industry saying that parents should do things. You know, like I think the first step is not making shitty products. You know, and
well, when you're talking about COD, I mean that doesn't solve the
problem. Oh yeah, sure. Like, we kind of went off on a tangent there.
No. It's applicable. But when it comes to COD and things like that, I mean, where. I mean, as best it can to advise parents that it's not suitable for kids.
I mean, even going super generic, I had, as I'm sure you all did, Army Men, you know. So I was playing War, even though I didn't play video game War, I think at that age it was Horace Goes Skiing. In a sense, yeah, I mean, kids are quite resilient, but, you know, that doesn't mean they're kind of oblivious to everything. And I think if you're feeding them kind of... More, I think the real question we have to deal with moving forwards is that that's a bit corporate.
I said moving forward in a previous episode, and
I think
Marsh is a PLC now.
I think a really interesting question when it comes to, and this is not just kids but adults as well, when it comes to the question of violence in games, it's getting more and more interesting because we're moving further away from abstraction and more towards realism. And I think that's particularly relevant with kids and the kind of things we're presenting to them, where a pixel man getting his head blown off is not the same thing as some of the stuff you see
in
COD. But
also the fantasies that we're engaging are more grounded in reality. I mean, the Thundercats was a big thing when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Now it's COD. I mean, there's a big kind of difference. And also, when you talk about global politics and global warfare and modern warfare, you are inherently carrying some kind of...
There is a political angle to this that wasn't present in Thundercats, is what you're saying.
Yes. It's strange that it needs to be stated, but...
much less broadly capable of making young Western children hate and mistrust the Middle East.
I've always hated skeletons, though, since He-Man, so...
I think even in the portrayal of violence, so...
Fuck skeletons.
I remember seeing the first showing of The Last of Us at E3, the trailer they showed was this desperate fight through these rooms, and you know, ends up with him shotgunning a guy in the face. I was like, wow, this is fucking intense and kind of horrible. I was a little bit slightly shocked by it. And that's the sort of stuff we're dealing with now, like that level of desperate kind of.
Like I remember Half-Life. I mean, and I think any anecdote supported evidence in this sort of thing is obviously going to be problematic because it's like my experience and in my day type arguments. But like, I remember Half-Life feeling incredibly realistic when I was, and that game came out when I was 12.
Jesus Christ.
11. No, I was 11. So
you're a tiny little child. A tiny baby.
Beat him up and steal his lunch money.
I got the demo, the day one version of the game they put out with a 3D card, that I played through with my dad. And we both thought it was brilliant because it was like the most realistic thing we'd ever seen. But in hindsight, that is a total fantasy. Like, I remember being the scariest game I'd ever played and the most violent and ever, because you're shooting like soldiers and stuff. But in hindsight, that's, you know, pretty banal fantasy because it's very much a sci-fi game set in a, you know, very heightened universe.
What's this meaning? Like, oppression by alien races that prevent you from breeding are bad?
Well, no, I'm Half-Life 1, not Half-Life 2.
Oh, sorry. Oh, well.
I'm not that young.
Because, well, then experiments that go wrong are bad, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Or, like, and then when the evil government shows up to shoot everybody, that felt edgy at the time, but, like, in comparison to the degrees being reached by stuff like...
That's true, it was edgy, wasn't it? The idea that the US government
shows up to shoot people. Yeah, I mean, like, this is what I'm saying, like, degrees of innocence. Like, I mean, before that I was playing Quake, which is a very violent game, but despite the blood and gore, is explicitly monsters are bad, which is not quite the same messaging as... Like, this is why I think there's a level of not, I don't want to kind of get all kind of, you know, broadsheety about it and be like, you know, danger. Is this dangerous? Is this dangerous? But there's something about the kind of po-faced attempt at sincerity that most modern war games attempt, despite being also fun shooters where you shoot the man and it's fun, that I find quite off-putting, because there are going to be people who can't see through that bullshit because they're either too young or whatever, that kind of buy in slightly to the messaging and think, no, this is really the most serious thing that's ever happened, and this is a reasonable depiction of it.
The number of copies that COD sold, I mean, just any singular COD that you pick since Modern Warfare, that the size of that as a multimedia entity means that for a very large number of people, that will be their largest and most powerful representation of war.
Yeah, I think exactly.
I mean, they won't necessarily watch the news. Mm. Yeah, that will be how they understand what warfare is.
Like, if I had a... It's horrifying. It's not really violence that bothered me, I think, because when I was, like, 13, like, my mum loves action movies, so, like, I watched loads of action movies, Under Siege, Broken Arrow, like, that sort of era of quite violent, sort of semi-realistic action movies. I don't think it's that. If I had, like, a 13-year-old kid, I would be more worried about them playing Call of Duty than Gears of War, for example.
Yeah.
Because Gears of War, despite being kind of quote-unquote gritty and very silly, it's still very silly, and it's monsters, and it's unreal in two ways.
Mark Rain's your biggest fan.
But, like, I'm okay with kids experiencing violence in the context where there is also a giant worm that eats cities, because that's just big. Yeah. It's big violence. It's like, chainsaws and stuff, and it's gross, and it's. But, like, I am still, as an adult, disturbed by, and now shoot the human in the head for his beliefs.
Yeah.
Which is the Call of Duty approach.
Or this person may have some information. Stick glass in his face until he tells you it.
Yeah,
I think like Call of Duty is strongly draws from the conceits of action cinema. I think as an adult, when you play it, you approach it as a silly action film. But as a child, you're not equipped with that knowledge.
That's interesting. Because we do talk about it. It's like, oh man, this is just like today's version of like a Steven Seagal movie from like 20 years ago. But actually, kids don't have that.
That's the problem.
We have this like irony armor that's built out of Steven Seagal's hair.
I've watched so many Steven Seagal movies. At one point, I'd watched all of Steven Seagal's movies.
He's both a chef.
He's continued
and an Aikido master.
Very inadvisably, he's continued making
while being a sheriff.
Yeah,
he's a chef and a sheriff.
And sometimes a chef. Sometimes he's an Eskimo. Sometimes he's a member of the Yakuza. He's brilliant. He's the most versatile actor of his generation.
Like, that's the thing.
He's put on a bit of weight, though, hasn't he?
Yeah, there was a point where his his films became bad at the point where he was too fat to still punch people, and he would just shot people instead.
Once you can no longer vault over a counter, it's over.
But if he's listening to this, I don't mean you're fat. Please
don't. Sorry,
please,
Steve.
Please don't pull my spine out the back of my
He's
body.
An Aikido master. He has to wait for you to hit first. It's fine.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Both Under Siege were
Fuck you, Seagal.
Also, saw him playing bluegrass in Cardiff once. Really? Yeah, it was a pity. He didn't kick anybody's head off, though.
Welcome to the Steven Seagal.
I guarantee some people came to that just in case a fight kicked off. Anyway,
Can I? Yes, please. The thing that is the most outraged I've ever been in a proper, like, I might write an editorial outrage, was being stood in a game retailer in queuing to buy something and listening to a conversation being had between a mother buying a Xbox, I think, and Call of Duty for her son, and the guy behind the counter. And this is probably the other side of the kind of, you know, does the industry do enough to protect kids argument, aside from the violence and the content of the games, was watching this, you know, woman who was pretty complimentous about the things she was buying and asking pretty much the right questions, be utterly shut down by a salesman whose only job was to sell more. And it was the worst possible combination of a parent who doesn't really know that they're buying an appropriate product for their child, not being challenged on it, and being oversold desperately due to kind of nefarious modern game mix, you know, overhead extending methods. So this kid obviously was getting an export from the conversation. It was like half term, I think, when I was in there, so that's why it was so busy. There was the context was everyone else is playing Call of Duty, so he has to have it. And then this was attached to, so like, okay, you got the console, you got the game. Would you like to get some Xbox Live time with that? Because you'll need it to play online. Oh yes, I suppose. And maybe why don't you also buy some Xbox Live points while you're at it? Because you'll need that to get the map packs. What's a map pack? Well, if you don't have a map pack, then you know you might not be able to play with your friends because you might have different levels in the game. And it was just this layered,
horrible shit.
Awkward. And I remember being back, like, I ended up not buying anything because I was so outraged by the entire process. It drove me to Amazon, which is probably like, you know what I mean? Like, literally,
I've stepped in that situation before. I've been in game and seen some poor mum getting, you know, railroaded by a salesman about Call of Duty.
And it was like, you know,
it's not like this. I fucking hate it.
I'm
about to get moral, so.
But nonetheless, that was. I just wanted to give that other side of the way in which the industry fails people. That, like,
yeah, the retail industry does. I think
they ban advertising to children flat out in Sweden, don't they?
I wouldn't be confident in saying that is the case, but they certainly have better consumer protections than we do.
I wonder how that works out for them. I don't know, it works fine. The globalisation is such a thing now, the internet's such a thing, that I wonder if peer pressure still exists for those kind of products, regardless of whether
they're... Oh, definitely.
Sure, but there's a difference between peer pressure and having that peer pressure enabled by a shop hungry to profit from it.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Hmm.
No, I don't disagree with that at all.
Shall we move on?
Yeah, sure. Just before we all get angry and fight.
All right. Hello, Crates and Crow Lolly Bars. It's quite sweet. I have a question about a recent trend of CCG mechanics in video games. CCGs happened in the 90s. They were at the gold rush and everyone was making one. On the one hand, I love the variety of strategic options and decisions these games open up. But on the other, I can't help but feel manipulated to shill more and more cash, or in some cases, grind more and more until I get the types of cards I want. So, Simus from Lithuania is talking about Hearthstone, Scrolls, Card Hunter, and even FIFA Ultimate Team. Mm. Wants an option to put down a reasonable amount of money for a full experience. What are your thoughts? Also, why isn't there enough love for Scrolls?
I like Scrolls.
I haven't actually played Scrolls.
I like Scrolls. Scrolls is really cool. I think Scrolls suffers a lot from Hearthstone coming out so close to it, because Scrolls is a really, really good game, but the visual layer isn't quite as sexy as Hearthstone. And I just think that's the only reason it's suffering. I think it's a great game otherwise.
I completely agree. With free-to-play games that have a unlock mechanic that's related to how you play the game, I always want the option to pay, a game price for something approaching that. Actually, Card Hunter, which he mentions, does have that. Hmm. There was a kind of 20 quid pack that, when you bought it on release, gave you a certain amount of time It unlocked every premium dungeon in the game, which was like all of the content you would miss if you didn't spend money, but also gave you a couple of months of the premium account level. But all the premium account level did was increase the rate you normally got cards at, so it didn't actually unlock anything that you wouldn't have access to normally. And I was quite satisfied with that.
Sounds like a cool way of doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, the reason that I stopped playing Hearthstone, actually, which I really like, is that you kind of, you get to a point where you're into the free to play game and you're kind of looking at the giant money tunnel that you might fall into if you kind of get properly into it. And Hearthstone is almost infinite. It's like, well, I can keep paying money to have a chance of getting the cards I need to make the ultimate deck I want, but there's no solid price to that. It could just be endless. If I get fucked by chance, by, you know, every card pack I open just doesn't have the cards I need, then it's going to take forever.
I would happily pay 20 quid just to unlock everything in Hearthstone. Sure. I don't want the fancy rare versions of the cards with the cool visuals or whatever. I just want to be able to play the full deck construction game.
That's right.
Without that limitation.
I guess it's not really necessarily CCGs that the problem there. It's the idea of grinding to kind of expand your game experience, which is the same problem with loadout that game I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Well, I guess more of the problem is that business model of selling infinite consumables is just so successful.
Yeah,
you know, there is an audience out there that loves that shit and keeps on making it very profitable. Anyway.
Says the owner of many gun skins for Counter Strike.
Yeah. I mean, but you know, Gaben crates are different because they're from Gabe.
But this, each like, one has been cursed by him.
I can make the same argument from Dota point of view. Like, I happily spend quite a lot of money on Dota because. Like, I'm going to defend this, right? Because the things I buy have no bearing on the mechanical experience whatsoever. It's all cosmetic. It's skins and new stuff for characters. But that game is like a hobby, and therefore I kind of invest in it. And I like being able to show off my investment in the game, which is not just a financial investment, but also a time and energy investment.
Whereas with Hearthstone, it's actually an impediment to your actually playing the game.
Like, it's also less visible over time. And I think visibility is a really interesting concept in this, that in a card game, you owning a card is only really an impact if you happen to draw it, right? Like, if you don't draw it, you might as well not own it. Like, it doesn't matter. Whereas the fact that I own, like, fucking magic wizard hair that costs quite a lot of money that I traded for desperately to get, when I love, like, Dota has...
Check this out, noobs.
Like, Dota has Arcana items, which I don't know if, like, the different... Arcana is, like, a level of rarity above everything else. And if you want to buy them from the shop, they're, like, single items that cost, like, 20 quid. Like, they're at the upper end of expensive. But they change a fuckload about the character, so they'll change the way abilities look, they'll change... a new one that was added recently changes the music that plays for everybody when that character respawns, which is fucking cool, because it means that when you respawn to the game, like, you get a fanfare, like, I'm back, fuckers!
when it comes crashing down...
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's what you... And so... but when you show up in a game with, like, one of these... And they do change something substantially visual about the character as well. When you show up with one, other players respond to it, which is exactly what you want, right? Like, and that might be like, oh my god, you've got such an expensive item, you fucking asshole, which is, you know, it's Dota, so, you know, there's a certain amount of that. But simply getting a rise out of people by showing up with my fabulous wizard hair is sufficient to make that ownership worthwhile in a way that just simply spending money to incrementally increase my chances of being successful in Hearthstone just doesn't have that degree of, like, I feel rewarded for, you know, having Alexstrasza, because I know that the person I play Alexstrasza onto is going to go, you twat.
Maybe I will buy that waggling pixelated
I think, to summarise, if it's entirely kind of cosmetic, it's awesome, because then it just depends on the quality of the game. And with Counter-Strike, for example, like, it makes no difference whether you're using the loadout and it's your first minute in Counter-Strike or whether you've played it for 400 hours. You have the same abilities. And the only difference between me and someone who hasn't played Counter-Strike is that my guns have a bit of different paint on them. And I, you know, I don't mind chucking in a fiver occasionally because I play Counter-Strike so often. And that's the truth of it. Like, when you get the value out of a game, you don't mind chucking a fiver into the slot machine, because that's what it is. You know, it's like, it is a fruit machine. Anyway, moving on to Sir Jolt, Dear Crayfish and Crawdads. I hope you'll excuse the marine intro, but I've been playing Assassin's Creed 4 on the strength of Marsh's recommendation.
Not mine. I think it was probably Tom Senior.
You're off to a bad start, Sir Jolt. As much as it's bowled me over, it struck me as tremendously sad that this level of cultural atmosphere is probably unattainable for games in non-historical settings. And that is basically Sir Jolt's question, whether we've come across games that are non-historical, that have this sense of cultural richness around them.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, we've talked about, like, lore building.
Are we going to get onto Dominions 4 again?
No, I'm going to stay away, but...
Hang on, is he talking about, like, not being historical in the sense of being modern day?
Or... No, I think what he means is that with Assassin's Creed games, you have a wealth of historical, cultural... stuff to pick up. Yeah. You can include sea shanties in it, which obviously are out of copyright. John Walker will be happy. They're all public domain items. And
those people aren't getting paid for that.
What about those dead sailors' families?
There's so many dead, unnamed, anonymous sailors.
I think the point is that Assassin's Creed mixes in real history with its animus bollocks.
But the real history is great.
Mixing real history with its bollocks.
I love those games, and they are enriched by the fact that I think I am learning stuff about Venice when I walk around Venice. I don't think you do get the same kind of thing with games that are in a fantasy setting. You get games which do have rich mythologies that are worth exploring in their own right, but there's a different kind of thing going on.
Totally. I think you can have the same attachment to the, I think that the historical reality portrayed in Assassin's Creed is so far removed from reality that it's essentially an equivalent fantasy to a complete, like,
I don't know,
to
I,
an
I
extent.
Think, yeah, I think when you can kind of compartmentalise it. Obviously, when you know you meet Leonardo DiCaprio.
He's in everything these days.
The really lesser scene. Don't say DiCaprio. Drink.
You can discount his participation in events with the Illuminati, etc., as fantasy. But then when you go and you read up, what are the kind of information dialogue boxes about?
Yes.
I know, the world church, or something like that. Yeah.
Climbed up
then I think those have been kind of fact checked to a large amount.
Yeah, you get this in like Civilization and stuff as well. Mm. But I kind of feel as though you were in such a contrived space at that point that it might as well be a complete fiction. I enjoy having these extra, like, if I want to delve into the depths behind the pop up icons that you know turn up when you climb a church, then that's cool and you are getting some actual genuine facts. But otherwise. It's, you know, it's all just nonsense, really.
Sir Jolt suggests in the bit of his letter I didn't read that one of the cool things about Assassin's Creed is, like, we've had hundreds of years for this stuff to filter out. So, for example, we've only got the best sea shanties. Whereas, like, doing stuff in a future science fiction setting is much, much harder because it's just one group of five creators, whereas those, well, I shouldn't have put a number on it. Whereas creators using historical settings can reach back and kind of pick the cream.
Well, there's certainly a lot more content that they can harvest from history. Mm. Like, I mean, if you need to fill out your game with songs, then it's easier to fill them out with sea shanties that already exist.
But not many games have done that well, have they? Like, Assassin's Creed does do it very, very well, but not many of them have.
Mm. Well, fill out their games with sea shanties, I completely agree.
More of that.
It's a shame.
We're ready to move on? To Mr. Juice, Weird Up, Cromand, and Concreteers? I've never heard that word before. Did he just make it up? Cromand. All right.
That's what the rest
well,
of the
well done, Mr. Juice. In recent years, board games have gone from being synonymous with Monopoly to meaning something you can actually enjoy without being wrong in the brain. Really? Really, Mr. Juice? Okay.
Wow. Do you disagree?
Yeah, I disagree massively. I think, well, anyway, let's get to the question. He likes Shut Up and Sit Down. We all like them. Do you guys play any board games? Do you think there's anything from the world of card and wood the PC gaming world could learn from? And are there any particular board games you would love to see computerized?
Yes to all of those.
Yep.
Yes to every single one.
I spent my weekend playing a bunch of excellent board and card sort of. I think board games is probably a misleading phrase now because not every game you play around a table with other humans in real time involves a board.
Yeah, if you say board game, people think Scrabble and Monopoly. Yeah.
Russian roulette doesn't have a board. Bloody lucky, wasn't it, Marty? Pity about Brian, but never mind.
Yeah. Oh, you need a board to, like, erect behind the person who. You know.
It's more of like a canvas sheet, usually, or newspaper. Anyway.
So, but I'd love to see a. I'd love to see a proper computer online version of something like Resistance or Werewolf, like a game that properly uses misdirection and lying. Mm. That'd be, I guess maybe Spy Party's got a little bit of that to it, but it's a two-player experience.
Let's assume Pride is as close as that kind of thing gets, I think.
Yeah, yeah, potentially. I'd like to see more.
I think we've said this on the podcast before, that lying is one of the kind of major social elements that exists in board games that does not translate that well to.
Well, I think it just hasn't been really explored. Yeah.
But it could be. There's no reason with the voice songs and everything else that you couldn't translate some of that experience to this medium.
And is there anything electronic games can learn from non-electronic games?
I know there are board games that I think would work well as electronic games. Like, there are board games that are just too complex for their own good. Too much maths. So stuff like Twilight Struggle, which is I've talked about a bit before on the podcast, like that could be a fucking amazing kind of one-on-one Cold War simulator thing where the maths happens behind the scenes, and it just kind of, it would pare it down to the decision making rather than the placing of tokens.
Yeah, so. I kind of think that the thing digital can bring us is a removal of that complexity with, like, I played some amazing board games where, like, the dice are just a put-off. Because you've got, like, 12 different types of dice, and you're like, well, you know, I can't really be asked with that, you know? Whereas, I don't know if that's necessarily something to learn. Anyway, moving...
I'd quickly indicate Space Alert, which is basically FTL.
Oh, yeah.
And you could draw a line between
the two. Is that the one with the CD?
That's right.
That game's incredible.
It's fucking amazing. But
and actually, like, FTL is that's a great point, kind of, because not many games use a timer in the way that game does.
Yeah,
although I found that game to be more a matter of memorising the timers than about making any kind of meaningful decisions.
But it shuffles, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because it only requires you to make a single failure of memory in order for everything that you do thereafter to be completely pointless. So, because it's all about, you listen to a series of events that play out on this recording, then you make decisions based on that. But it's all time based. So if you mistime anything based on a fault in your recollection, then everything is just shagged and you are fucked and everybody dies. So it kind of feels like very digital. Like either things work out.
Did you ever play Atmosphere? Remember that game with the VHS tape?
Yeah, I had that.
Our family had that. We had loads of board games, actually. It's kind of funny. I don't think about them much these days, but we used to play board games quite frequently.
So what was your objection?
My objection?
Yeah, when you...
Oh, well, no, it was his first sentence. He said, Mr. Juice said, in recent years, board games have gone from being synonymous with Monopoly to meaning something you can actually enjoy without being wrong in the brain, which I just thought was rather unnecessarily wrong and provocative.
Do you not think that's true? I think when I was a kid, like, board games, at least in my family, the board games, if you said board games, were Monopoly and Cluedo.
But that's families. Like, it was the same for my family. I think, like, it'll be the same for my daughter. Like, because Monopoly is easy to play. You roll a die.
Yeah.
Like, that is the kind of game you play with kids. Like, you don't play Carcassonne with a 5-year-old.
So it's not actually something that's changed over the period of our lives. It's changed for
us. No, there have always been these awesome board games. Like, the Spiel des Jahres has been going on. That's the German competition for the top board game. That's been going on since the 70s.
Game of the year, that means.
And, you know, like... These games have existed, it's just that I guess the internet is making them a little more obvious. And it's weird, actually, like, the internet didn't do that initially, but in the last year or two, maybe it's just because, like, a lot of our friends are involved in this scene, but it certainly seems like board games are becoming trendier, but that doesn't necessarily mean they weren't existing in these awesome forms before.
I think they're trendy among like journalists or people who are kind of examining mechanics, because they're so exposed in board games, card games, and you can kind of examine them.
I don't think it's necessarily solely the case. I think there's also a community that a pretty hardcore board games community that's now for the first time being served properly by media, by the SUST guys, that have always been there, but they haven't had a media for them in such a public way before. So yes, it's partly a case of game journalists discovering board games, and partly a case of board games getting actual media coverage that they deserve.
It's kind of interesting that, like, some of the Shut Up and Sit Down guys were games journalists who've come across and become really fascinated by, like Quinn's, who just went across to...
I think Quinn's was always interested in board games, though, I think.
Yeah, totally. But
that was definitely my path. I was a games journalist first, and then I got interested in board games.
Yeah, that's definitely the case for me as well.
Interesting.
Okay, so we've got our last letter here, which it sounds like it's repeating an earlier letter, but actually it's not, and it's a very interesting point. So this is from forest. Which, just forest.
A forest. Which,
yeah, like, to me, is just the guy who dies at the start of the first Resident Evil. Dear Adam and Joe, has he got the right podcast?
There's another guy who wrote in, I don't know if we read out the question, that was just, hi, thumbs.
So, what Mr. Forrest, I presume it's Mr. Forrest, might be Miss Forrest, is talking about is our favourite topic of ludonarrative dissonance. But, wait for that drink. He's talking about seeing Peter Grimes at the opera. This particular interpretation removed Grimes' sexually ambiguous relationship with his apprentices and rather just portrayed him as a serious, insular man who believed in his own innocence and refused to engage with hoi polloi and their gossiping. Anyway, I had to accept there were two threads running throughout the work, the beautiful singing and the narrative, which is obviously quite grim. Occasionally coming apart, the chorus raising the alarm for the coming storm, but also straying far apart. And it made me wonder whether ludonarrative dissonance is a problem, or merely just a lazy way of writing off Uncharteds and CODs in a way that seems profound.
Wow.
Which I think is a very good question.
I think sometimes it's the problems raised by ludonarrative dissonance are exacerbated.
We don't have much booze left.
No, I've run out, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
By the otherwise failures in narrative. I do think play is a very good at compartmentalising experiences and able to judge each compartment separately in a way which does not necessarily detract from their experience of the rest. So I don't think it's necessarily a problem. Like in Deus Ex, I don't mind. I can absorb that narrative and I don't feel I'm breaking that narrative when I jump on a desk and spin around during a cutscene or something like that. You know, I actually find those two things separate. I can kind of consume them separately. The problem is when things are contingent in the narrative upon your behaviour and the two things don't match up, that's when the problems arise, I think.
To a degree, pointing out things about games that are dissonant is kind of base pedantry quite a lot of the time. It is the, you know, well, why can't I do this? I've talked before about how I think one of the things that my attitude to games sort of makes happen that maybe doesn't happen in other cases is I tend to meet games halfway on narrative.
Hmm.
Like, I'll say, I don't really care whether your narrative is highbrow, lowbrow, middlebrow. I'll kind of try and engage with it on its own terms and give you the benefit of the doubt enough to kind of maybe still tell me a story that I care about. And it takes more for a game to fail me, I think, narratively than other people because I'm much more charitable.
Like, I think the problem this guy has with the opera is like a stylistic dissonance rather than natural narrative dissonance. Like, I think someone expressing themselves through a beautiful song is when he has expectations about what a gritty plot should be and how that should be communicated, which is based on modern media. And it's not actually like ludonarrative means to play. It's about agency. It's about how your agency clashes with how that's manipulated by things that are out of your control, which is cutscenes and things like that. I think it's a different issue that he's talking about.
What I was going to say was that as you engage with a game and as you kind of try and like make yourself attached to it, which is kind of what I was talking about, that, you know, extending this charity to a game that, yeah, I'm going to kind of try and engage with the story, then you expect certain things to at least be sort of reciprocated and you're sort of surprised, actually sometimes often surprised, when it's your own agency as a person, not your agency as a game player, that ends up getting rewarded. That, I think, is that I think is the goal to which criticizing things on the grounds of ludonarrative dissonance is valid, right? When you're trying to progress towards a type of like play experience that is about rewarding people for just behaving relatively naturally in whatever situation they find themselves in, and not according to a preset set of rules that you expect games to follow, that's when things become good, I think. You know, to further the Deus Ex example, that's when you find yourself fleeing from guards because you feel like fleeing from guards is the right thing to do, not loading a quick save. That's the success of narrative, you know, harmony.
The difference between the dissonances he's describing there is that in, for example, GTA 4, Nico is constantly going, oh, I'm a reformed gangster, I'm reluctantly being brought back into crime, and you're thinking, I'm really not that reluctant. I quite like running over people. And yeah, the equivalent for that in Peter Grimes' The Opera would be if whenever Peter Grimes started singing, everybody else was like, fuck hell, this guy can't sing at all. But but the two things are actually separate. Like, the media through which those stories are being told are separate. And that's the dissonant part. It's not that they have a mismatch thematically or narratively.
I mean, there's also an extent to which... God, I'm going on to musical theatre, aren't I?
Oh, God.
So, you know, directors make decisions about the sides of a production they're going to bring out without changing necessarily the structure of production. Mm. So you can keep the singing and maybe refocus, you know, the character elsewhere, or the choose to draw things out from the text in a different way. That's kind of considered probably, in most cases, valid in theatre, for example, regardless of the structural conceit. So you're completely right. It is a kind of tonal thing rather than a... rather than a kind of loop narrative thing, obviously, in this case. But, interestingly, this is actually grounds for criticism, right? I can't criticise this particular production of Peter Grimes because I haven't seen it, but if you were to say that, hang on, this production has focused on an element of this character which doesn't actually match what the text wants you to do in terms of stage direction, music, everything else, then you may have taken the show in the wrong way. If you're so keen to remove, for example, sexual ambiguity from the show, that you then end up making it dissonant, that is actually an interesting way of pointing a production towards where it actually should be going. But, you know, I'm saying, like, I always, there used to be a trend, I think, that you take sort of, like, quote-unquote edgy shows and translate them, and as they kind of drifted further into, like, regional theatres and things, you'd start to have trouble with things like sexual ambiguity being stripped away mercilessly until everyone was a kind of, like, rational operator who also maybe broke into song from time to time. And that is a trend that you can helpfully criticise by using that dissonance and tracing it back to its source. And I think that's probably the key for games as well. Like, when you think, hang on, this thing I'm being told jars with this thing I can do, rather than go, like, you know, ludonarrative dissonance, take a drink, pat yourself on the back, do a tweet, whatever, maybe trace it back to why you feel that way and whether it's actually a serious problem with the game itself or something about your own attitude.
Yeah.
I think that's all we've got time for.
It is all we've got time for.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. If you'd like to ask us a question, you can email us at questions@crateandcrowbar.com. You can tweet us @crateandcrowbar. You can leave a question on our forums. There's a dedicated sub-forum for questions, which is at crateandcrowbar.com/forum. Or you can tweet us as individuals at... This is so close to being perfect. my name is Chris Thurston, and I'm at C Thurston, C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N. Rich?
I am at Rich Stanton, R-I-C-H-S-T-N-T-O-N.
I'm at PCG Ludo, L-U-D-O.
And I'm at Marsh Davis, which is D-A-V-I-E-S.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
We love you.